Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, folks, it's Casual Friday. And Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for the Washington Post, will mosey on to the show, as will Jason Miles, co-host of the This Is Revolution podcast, talk about his excellent piece he posted on Medium, I Was a Teenage Anarchist. Also on the program today, White House wants a reconciliation and infrastructure vote ASAP. They want it next week, as Mancinema continue to hack away at that reconciliation bill. House voted yesterday to find Steve Bannon in contempt of Congress, and now it's in the hands of Merrick Garland and the DOJ. Texas Governor Abbott puts Trump's election lawyer in charge of the Texas Election Review. CDC endorses boosters for Moderna and J&J, and the mix and match. Yes. Human Rights Watch releases 160 reports of abuse of asylum seekers at the hands of federal border officials. The DOJ adds prosecutors to Matt Gaetz's case. Kevin McCarthy drops the hammer, blacklisting Republican operatives who work with Liz Cheney. I was going to say, may they all fall off the planet. Alec Baldwin accidentally kills a cinematographer on his film set, a result of a failed prop gun. Israeli Defense Minister labels six Palestinian human rights groups as terror organizations. And in New York State, 12 workers formed the first farm worker union in New York, if not in decades, maybe, I mean, certainly since almost 100 years. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. Joining me, as she does every day. In fact, she joins me on days I'm not even here. Mm-hmm. Emma Vigeland. Hello,
you're,
Emma.
Hello, you were with us in spirit yesterday. I would say maybe you haunted us.
Was there tech problems?
No. But there was Apple discussions.
Oh.
Without you.
Whoa, that's a little awkward.
Yeah.
That is a little awkward. Don't like to hear anything like that, but okay.
The point is that The Bachelorette had a debate with a guy who showed up dressed as an apple. And he said he was a Granny Smith, and he was in a red suit. And she listed at him like 5 to 6 to 7 separate apples that he could have been, and he totally flubbed his entrance by saying he was a Granny Smith. The point being is that you should...
The guy could have been really 2,500 apples.
Yes, and you would have obviously bested her. She's a teacher, that's why he was dressed as an apple. You have to keep up.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah. So you should maybe, I don't know if they're still filming, probably not, you should probably apply to date this woman on The Bachelorette. She has the apple acumen that you so seek.
Could be a mid-season addition to the
right, exactly.
Yeah, that's unlikely. Nevertheless, I appreciate that apples were discussed yesterday on the program in my absence. That's always good to hear. It is Friday, and as we head into the weekend, we like to look back. Dave Weigel is with us. You know, we're going to talk more about the infrastructure bill by the end of next week. They may hold a vote next week. Pelosi apparently wants to do that in the House. I think it's unlikely they're going to get this bill together by then. We are going to have, increasingly, there's going to be recriminations about how this, what was once an incredibly ambitious bill, is now been just eviscerated in many, many ways. But first, last night, Joe Biden went on CNN for a town hall. And one of the first things that came up, or one of the first things we're going to talk about, is the filibuster. There has been talk that because the Republicans shot down Joe Manchin's election bill, that he would maybe come around on some type of filibuster reform for election bills. And I think that is unlikely, although there have been more Senate institutionalists who have come around on this a little bit in the past couple of days, but it remains to be seen. But one of those Senate institutionalists that have come around is Joe Biden. Here is that exchange between him and Anderson Cooper last night in a CNN town hall.
When it comes to voting rights,
is equally as consequential.
When it comes to voting rights, just so I'm clear, though, you would entertain the notion of doing away with the filibuster on that one issue. Is that correct?
And maybe more.
And maybe other issues.
He's looking at the ground. Project strength and look at the audience. It's just a little odd.
Right. Anyway. We should say Angus King and John Tester, sort of have come around a little bit, and, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, similarly situated as a Manchin. It's good that Biden is now saying this because I think maybe it's indication that he understands that Joe Manchin will always take three steps away from where Joe Biden is.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit more about the sort of the performative aspects of what Joe Biden was doing last night. First off, and I vowed to myself, like, not to harp on the failures of the Democratic leadership, specifically Schumer and Biden. I think there's some issues with what Pelosi has done, but they passed the bill in the House. And that, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. The failure of the Biden administration to read the room, the failure of the Democratic leadership in the Senate to know the caucus, to share the fact that Joe Manchin, that they had signed a contract with Joe Manchin.
So this is Schumer.
Schumer.
And Biden, of course.
And Biden and the White House. I mean, yeah. And here is just a prime example. Like, look, it's quite possible that there was never a universe in which there was going to be a $3.5 trillion bill or a $6 trillion bill. It's quite possible. So the only assessment that we can make is, did the leadership of the Democratic Party do everything that they could in a competent way to attempt to pass a $3.5 trillion bill or a $6 trillion bill, whatever it is? And I just don't think that there's any way you can assess this and say the answer is yes. Case in point, Joe Biden is doing a town hall last night with CNN. Is he doing it because he just hasn't had a chance to talk to Anderson Cooper in a long time?
Is he doing it because he now needs to go on the offensive when he could have done that months and months ago instead of playing prevent defense and having like hashtag trust the senatorial process? I mean, that's what he's been doing for months and months.
If he's out there trying to push the reconciliation bill across the finish line, he is his folks are tacitly conceding that there is value in him going out and pushing it. There is no less resistance to this bill now than there was 6 months ago. In fact, I would say the opposite. And so if in their mind it's to work today, mm-hmm. in mid-October, late October, there's no reason why it couldn't have worked in May.
Now let's do it after he just sheds popularity for a couple months.
Exactly.
Right.
So here he is. This is the he is asked about Medicare. Let's do that. Originally, the provision that most people were hoping for was a drop in the Medicare eligibility age to 60 and an expansion of the services for Medicare recipients. And let's be clear on this. There is a lot of reasons to do this on just simply a human level. But as a political matter,
yep.
people over the age of 65 broke towards Biden in a very surprising way in the last election. If you want to make sure they're there in the midterms and you want to make sure that they're there in 2024, they are high propensity voters. They are very aware of the benefits that they get from their government. And this would have been an excellent way of doing it. Here's Biden with Cooper.
One of the other things that Democrats are looking to do is to expand Medicare to include dental, vision, and hearing as well. Given all the negotiations that are going on, will all three of those still be covered?
That's a reach. And the reason why it's a reach, I think it's a good idea. And it's not that costly in relative terms, especially if we allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. But here's the thing. Mr. Manchin is opposed to that, as is, I think, Senator Sinema is as
opposed
well.
Opposed to all of them?
Opposed to all three, mm-hmm. because they don't want, he says, he doesn't want to further burden Medicare.
Yes, and that's BS.
Well, she's also against the negotiating of the pharmaceuticals by Medicare, which would have provided all the savings that you needed for these things. Now, here is, we mentioned this on Wednesday, the FDA is looking to get hearing aids to be non-prescription. So when you start hearing the inclusion of hearing aids into the expansion of Medicare, understand this is BS. This is
window dressing.
It's not a question. It is a distraction.
Yeah.
It is an attempt to say we can trade away the dental, which is really the big expense here. We can trade away the dental. We can trade away the vision, also a big expense because of we allow for such monopolistic practices when it comes to eyewear.
And just to make it clear to people, because you mentioned it earlier, where we started with these negotiations was a twofold conversation that Bernie Sanders was pushing to include dental, hearing, and vision in Medicare and expand those benefits and to lower the eligibility age. Bernie and the progressives have all but conceded that massive component of the lowering of the eligibility age to 60. And now we're talking about cutting what the entire caucus seemingly agreed to in terms of expanding the benefits in an additional way. I mean, that's suicide politically, as you mentioned. And that's purely because the Biden administration kind of just let the game play out in front of them and didn't take an active role here.
We want to be clear, too, that we had that issue with the question of, do you invite the Republicans in? I mean, this, we'll go through the sort of the timeline. I mean, because I think this is going to be helpful at one point or depressing at one point.
And
helpful and depressing.
It's the same. But, it's the same flaw that he has with the Republicans. Like, I trust these people to negotiate in good faith, and I'm going to let the negotiations play out in this way, as opposed to taking an aggressive offensive approach, which now he has to be like, oh, please save the hearing portion of this like Medicare expansion bill.
They slow walked this reconciliation bill.
Yeah.
Maybe not on purpose. They were under the completely bizarre belief that they needed to open this up to the Republicans in and walk them into the White House in the spring. And then it was Portman and Sinema. and all the while giving people like Manchin and Sinema and the Chamber of Commerce and the drug lobby and the dentists the opportunity to amass war chests and strategies to fight this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Huge mistake. And then it's also just a question of just simple messaging. Here is Joe Biden with Anderson Cooper in the same CNN town hall in Baltimore last night. Senator Manchin has said, despite the fact that he basically walked his daughter into a fake degree in a university in West Virginia when he was governor so that she could get a job with a pharmaceutical and could essentially price gouge when it came to EpiPens. Or was it, I think it was EpiPens.
Yes.
This guy doesn't want anybody getting too comfortable with these small checks for their children to help them with dealing with costs and expenses that are associated with having kids. So that he wants a means test on the child tax credit. Here's Joe Biden's response to this. If I don't listen to anything Joe Biden says and someone just tells me he's against it, I'm happy. But when I listen to what he says, I get completely lost and flummoxed because there is some bizarre belief system that they have in the White House that nothing can be straightforward. Here it is.
Joe Manchin wants a work requirement with your enhanced tax credit for kids. Is that something you would support?
No. Here's the deal. All these people are working anyway. And by the way, you know, why should somebody who is not working and has, you know, makes, has a $1 million trust fund, why should they get the benefit and someone making 60 grand and not working but staying home, why should they not get anything? I don't get that.
You know what? I don't get that ridiculous analogy.
Yeah.
Okay. So how about this? How about instead of like coming up with this fictional person who has $1 million trust fund, who is working and getting the reduced check because it does go down with your, as your income goes high. And I don't even know, like, is this person have access to the $1 million trust fund or they don't have access? I can think about that. How about this? How about we shouldn't punish kids who are vulnerable because their parents can't find work? How about if you really are concerned about getting people back to work, let's work on some programs for that. But let's make sure that parents have enough support to raise our kids in the way that we want them to. I mean, this is easy, basic stuff.
Well, yeah.
You've got to start going into sort of these hypotheticals about people who have $1 million trust funds, but they're actually working because they don't have access to the trust fund, but there's somebody they're going to have the trust fund. And so they're the trust fund, the $1 million that they have with the trust fund's not undercutting the means test on the, like, what?
Doesn't every working person you know talk about trust funds on the regular?
Yeah, it's a very just, familiar scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just some, I like,
it's so complicated.
Do they not know in the White House he was going to do this? Did they not know that was a question they were going to get? Of course they did.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just bizarre.
Here's the deal. All these people are working anyway, which is essentially saying, look, we don't need a work requirement. We're already coercive enough under our capitalist system.
We agree with the work requirement. We just don't need it.
Yeah, it's already built into our society. It really is a layup in a variety of ways. And say he still wanted to make the commitment, you know, use his old phrasing about how, like, people need to be back to work, etc. You could just say the pandemic has shown us that you can lose your job through no fault of your own. He loves to say that. Again, this is me talking as Biden. And we shouldn't have children bear the brunt of it. And that's the you can use the pandemic to that for that. And he chose not to, of course.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Weigel, the national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Folks, a couple of sponsors today. Two of my favorite. First off, SunsetLakeCBD.com. They are movement sponsors of this program. 20% off. They're fans of the show. 20% off if you use the code LEFTISBEST. The tinctures that allow me to sleep at night when my child does not wake me up. They have CBD in multiple different doses, and like in terms of how much a meg, but also they also have it with melatonin. They have embedded, what do you call it? Infused fudge. Tremendous. Also, they have coffee, infused coffee. They have kief, smokables. Matt, why don't you talk about what you do with those smokables?
Oh, well, I have an ounce of kief here. I keep forgetting to lug back across Brooklyn. But what I will do with this is mix it into my other smokables, as you call them, in my grinder. And it pads it out nicely. And it creates a nice little soothing, sort of relaxing vibe to what to my experience.
They have Arnica Salve that has been great for me personally with my eczema, but it's for muscles. They have hand lotion. They have gummies. Really great products. They're a great company. They use integrated pest management. They use regenerative farming practices, 100% organic fertilizer. And they have been really supportive of not only the things that we've done here in terms of fundraising for Afghan refugees, but they are the ones who sort of like let us know about what was going on in Worcester with the St. Vincent's Union and helped send money to support those folks. They have been involved in the longest nurses' strike in the history of Massachusetts.
Wow.
Up in Worcester. They do a lot of stuff in the Burlington area. Just a great company all around. $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned. SunsetLakeCBD.com, 20% off. Left is best is the code. Left is best is the code. So check that out. Really great folks there. Also, Bradley, you got to text him. You got an old email for him or something.
He's in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Also, today's show is sponsored by mysolarnerd.com. What is mysolarnerd.com? Well, Danny is a listener of the program. He is a solar consultant, fan, longtime listener of the program, and he was working for some solar companies. Felt like what he was seeing was not helpful for folks who wanted to go solar. Some of that stuff gets a little bit predatory at times. He set up this consultation business. So if you're a homeowner, you're thinking about going solar, and you don't know exactly what the best route to take, well, mysolarnerd.com is your solution. You can retrofit your home with solar for no money down at this point. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings in their first year. And there is a solar investor tax credit that was going away. Apparently, the provisions from the some of the COVID relief have kicked in. So the 26% solar tax credit got extended into next year. At that point, by 2023, it will be down 4 points to 22%. So now is the time to act. And My Solar Nerd's mission is simple. They want to find you the best solar program for your home, make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. And this is what they do. They analyze your usage. They find the best equipment for your needs based upon where you're located and what kind of structures you have on your property, et cetera. They figure out the incentives and the financing that you might qualify for. And then they project manage the process between you and the installers. They obtain the permits. They do everything that is needed. So don't forget, the current 26% tax credit, it's been extended into next year, but then it goes down to 22%, and then it goes away. They also, in some areas, depending on where you are, if you're prone to power outages, you may qualify for off-the-grid backup solutions, which sound really cool. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. Go to mysolarnerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report listener for how you heard about mysolarnerd.com so that you can receive that $200 gift card upon installation. But bottom line is, folks, mysolarnerd.com will walk you through that process. Lastly, just a reminder, or I should say an announcement, the live show that we're doing at the Wilbur Theater, the famed Wilbur Theater in Boston, it actually is sort of pretty famous, January 16th at 3 p.m. It's a Sunday, so the people can travel in, travel out if you want to. The link for that is now live for everyone. Head to thewilbur.com/artist/majority-report. We'll put a link in our podcast and YouTube description because that's a ridiculous URL. But now it's open to everybody. So check it out. Get your seats, folks. All right. I want to welcome to the program the national political correspondent and driving instructor for the Washington Post, Dave Weigel. Dave, how are you? Welcome. Emma Villan's here with me, too.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? I'm good. I'm in Minneapolis for a story, and I realize that car interviews have been normalized by sovereign citizens, so it's not weird that I'm doing this at all.
No, it is not weird. It looks great. I was just going to say, I was literally going to start the interview by saying that the reason why I wanted to... Where did he go?
Still here, Dave?
I'm still here.
Oh, all right. Wait, we lost your... The reason why I wanted you on the program this week is because I know that you're on the road and wanted to get a sense of what was going on out there. You, of course, also write the trailer, which refers more to the campaign trail than it does like what you may have hitched behind that vehicle that you're in right now. But
check the trunk, by the way. Please don't check the trunk. No reason in particular. Just don't check it.
It doesn't look like... Do you have a trunk in that? What are you driving there?
It's got to be a rental car, right?
Yeah, it's a rental car. It's a Ford EcoSport, which has a door that's so weird that I had to look up on YouTube how to open it. But that's not what you're asking about.
But that is... well, I do want to talk about why you're out there. But I want to go through some of the pieces that you've had at the trail over the past month or so, starting with one of the most recent, which was just a couple of days ago. There is we're around fundraising time right now. Let's start with actually what's going on with January 6th, because what is your sense with the sensitivity of voters out there to what's going on with the reconciliation bill and the infrastructure bill? Like how much attention is being paid by voters, and to the extent that they pay attention to it, like how first order is it? Are they out there going like, what's happening with the Medicare expansion? Or are they just getting this message that two senators are rolling the entire Democratic Party?
I'm not even sure if they get that message. It doesn't come up much unless candidates bring it up, and they bring it up. Terry McAuliffe in Virginia is a good example. Phil Murphy said the same thing in New Jersey. They bring it up saying, look, we know what we want to do if we get this, if this money goes out. We know how we do pre-K, our states can alleviate some of our budget pressure. Just do it already. But when it comes to voters, I don't hear much talk about it. I think it is just the flattening of if things are happening. And this is the problem with any legislative fight about anything. If that thing in D.C. is happening slowly and people aren't all agreeing on it, there must be something bad about it. Now, I'm one of the people who says, like, you get unanimous votes really quickly on things like Havana syndrome relief. I mean, you don't, anything worth doing is going for either party is going to be complicated, but people are just tuning out. It's not like the health care bill 12 years ago where people know there's a part of my life that will be affected if this passes. I don't think it's that clear yet. And Democrats haven't tried to, they've sold some stuff that will be part of some people's lives, but not touching everybody's lives the way healthcare did. And frankly, the way that Republicans campaigned against the ACA was, if this bill's complicated, they won't tell you what's in it. We're going to tell you some stuff that's going to do that may or not be real. That's not even really happening with this. Republicans aren't even really attacking the bill. It's just in the air.
Have you noticed that, like, the marketing of Build Back Better, what policy pieces are resonating with people? Because, like, you've seen polling on the individual components of what's in it, the child tax credit, the universal pre-K, whatever the case may be. Individually, they poll great. But the fact that it's in this large package, I'd imagine, dilutes it to a degree the way people are seeing it being negotiated.
Yeah, but I don't even think they're paying super close attention now. I just think when I talk to voters, it doesn't come up naturally, and the worries they have are there's some about child care, but it's really if you're a plugged in liberal voter, you're annoyed with Sinema and Manchin. If you're just kind of vaguely paying attention, you really are paying more attention to COVID, and it's not like prices are up or shelves are empty and I hate Joe Biden now, but hey, is he going to do anything to fix that? You hear that more. If they were passing the supply chains are gone for some, magically bill of 2021, I feel like people would be, or not gone, fixed. People would be paying a lot more attention to that. But no, and Democrats complain about this, but they're, it matches my experience that because the coverage is there's this bill and it's really expensive, that's all they hear. That's all that it gets manifested. When they go to their districts, they're touting, here's what we did already with the rescue plan. Here's what would come here if we get this extra money. But it's kind of amorphous for people. And I was trying to say before, the plus side is that Republicans aren't really making anything stick on it either. It's not like previous legislative fights where they're out there messaging every day. They're just distracted by other stuff, or they're kind of pinpointing parts of the bill that they think sell well because they don't think attacking the whole bill on its own. Even the reconciliation package, the $3.5 trillion, everything in it, that was popular. They never really found a way to attack it. So in one way, if Democrats get it over the line, the fact that people are not paying a ton of attention right now is probably helping them.
Well, I mean, I think it actually is because there has been a lack of Republican demonization of the bill.
Yeah.
That there isn't that the bill remains popular, at least in the context of what's in it. But there is it shows the vacuum that it was created by the Democrats not coming out and seizing. It's like, I hate to use a football analogy here, but it's like the Republicans are on their 30-yard line, but the Democrats decide to line up on their 30-yard line instead of walking up where the ball is and taking advantage of and going on offense. They haven't done any of that. We saw Biden go out and try and do it last night, I guess, on CNN. It seems a little late to do that. So from the perspective of talking, and I'm curious if it's different, whether it's, you're talking to sort of center left or center right of across the spectrum, what are the voters that you talk to talking about? Is it COVID and just the idea of maybe inflation, or
more than anything anything that's being discussed in Washington this second? Definitely. And it's really it really is just people spend a year, maybe more for some people, maybe a little bit less for some, year not interacting with society at the same level. And so there's just a constellation of stuff that's different and stuff that's weirder. And I think Democrats, when they've gotten people to pay attention to their bill, it's been, well, there's a child care component that would be very helpful for specifically the problem that a lot of people are having right now. But until there is a child care proponent, part of the bill, a component of the bill that gets passed and that we can discuss it, that's not really part of the conversation either. And for Republican voters, they're not really paying attention to much of this. Now, it's automatic. If there's a problem, it's because Biden's president. He shouldn't be. But the discussion with them really is just about just the voters I talked to in Virginia last week. It's the schools are out of control. Why are they teaching kids race? It's kind of. I don't want to be patronizing, but it does feel like, both bases can be somewhat programmed by the media. I feel that, but it happens faster on the right. I mean, the work Fox News put into making the activist story of the year, the thing to care about, the schools, that's more what I hear from Republicans, and they're not paying attention. It's just, now the thing about politics now is they're kind of written out of the conversation because even Democrats I talk to say, well, we assume that every Trump voter is going to vote against us. That's fine. It's about getting those other people. So they kind of ignore, and I think this has played out in some races, they just think they're going to talk about something else. We're going to ignore it. Sometimes it works. I think it hasn't been in the last couple of weeks. But nothing else that the government is doing right now is filling in the gap as a fun thing people like talking about.
What do you attribute the precipitous fall of Joe Biden's popularity numbers, favorability numbers to? Is it just that people are frustrated with COVID and they're like, he's president, so?
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of that, and that's always a little bit cheap, right? Because there are Republican governors, officials going out of their way to make sure that people don't get a vaccine and then saying, hey, how come this vaccine rate's low? I thought Biden was going to fix that. Right. That I think you can write off. I think it's more just there are little irritations in life. And beyond voters, man, I have just friends I grew up with who are not journalists, who have pretty normal lives. Some are conservatives and some are moderate Democrats. And that's their thing. It's just that there's an angst like, I thought things would snap back and I had everything I used to. Now I have a version of those things, but some of it's more complicated. Some of it's more expensive. Some of it's taking longer to get here. And this is not really a thing that a party can message. I mean, if you live in a capitalist society and people can't get stuff as fast, well, if the entire system, the entire economic system, the entire, happiness delivery system of the country is you can get stuff whenever you want. You can fill your man cave. You can make, not even have to think about feeding your family. But then that's going to be an issue. I think some of it too, and everything ends up being a media conversation, but it also, it's a little bit overdetermined. I mean, I'll read like an article about the shelves being completely empty and I'll notice, oh yeah, there was that day when I went to the store at 9 and then the next day I came and it was full. Like there, things are a little bit bad, but not totally off kilter. And yet that is the perception. I think that's real. That a thing that never used to happen being a little bit worse, that people notice that. And if one party, one network is saying it's all about to collapse, the fact that shelf is empty means we're already on the road to being Cuba, Venezuela, take your pick. That's pretty powerful. I don't think Democrats have like a great answer for that. They just need that to be fixed somehow. And that's not what that's just not part of the conversation in Congress. Congress could pass a bill that says build three times as many ports in Long Beach. They wouldn't be done tomorrow.
And I'm not sure that would actually make a difference because you don't have the truck drivers to take them off. My understanding is that there's a ton of stuff sitting in that port. It's the problem of the truck drivers to take it. So, I mean, so to at least to some extent, this is contextual as much as anything else. And that context could theoretically change over the course of the next year. But let's talk about this other piece that you wrote, which I find really interesting and is somewhat consistent with what I've been thinking for a while, right? Like the Republicans have their issue sets, which of course is that you're now teaching graduate level critical race theory classes in kindergarten, which of course does seem ridiculous to do because they haven't gone through some of the survey courses before, but et cetera, et cetera. The Democrats, it seemed to me, have had this opportunity to actually run against something or someone in a midterm in a way that Republicans always seem to come up with, right? Like they would go against Obamacare or the Clintons. They did this, it seems like, for decades. But the Democrats could run against Donald Trump in the midterm elections. And that seems to be what they're doing. And they're using January 6th as a mechanism to do that. Will you talk about that? Because that to me, I think, I don't know that they're executing that strategy in the way that I would suggest that they do it, but they're at least pursuing that strategy.
Yeah, they are. And it's noticeable to me. I wrote about it this week because I go and check what were the ads 3 years ago, the ads 5 years ago, what are the ads now? And The Democratic thinking of 2018 and for a lot of 2020 was, if you're just focusing on Trump, then people think you don't stand for anything else. It does have a way of overwhelming things. You could run 10 ads about your tax plan, one ad about Trump, and it'll be, why are you talking about Trump so much? What January 6th did change that, and Trump's approach to the post-presidency changed that, because he is driving the news for driving the news and also the belief systems of Republicans. That is unique. I mean, we always like, in political reporting, to find an analog or find a narrative that has been part of this before. That is pretty unique. Maybe you could go to, you know, Teddy Roosevelt clamoring throughout 1909, 1910, and then coming back and running again. But Republicans around the country weren't at that time just changing what they stood for because Teddy Roosevelt told them to. This is new. And so it happens that these three, if we conclude the California recall, all the big statewide races this year are in Democratic states. And the Democratic theory is, look, we have some problems, but demographically right now we know there are lots of white liberals who just don't vote in off-year elections and might be unhappy about issues 1, 2, or 3. But those white liberals, if we really emphasize that Donald Trump, who you thought you beat, is still here and is shaping everything that you were worried about is still happening because of him. That's what they're trying. So you see images of January 6th and everything down to, you know, state legislative races in Virginia. There's a Republican who had some clients who were January 6th protesters. Democrats run against that. There's the Republican Governors Association did some robocalling, to show up on January 6th back when it was promoting the Trump rally. Democrats are using that. So any kind of Republican connection to it, they're using, and they're kind of beasting it out because they're getting some criticism. I always find it ironic. If you turn on cable, CNN or MSNBC, it's about Trump about half the time, generously. It's probably more than that. But I've noticed they'll bring on a Terry McAuliffe or Phil Murphy and say, like, are you talking too much about Trump? They're kind of revealing. Well, no, they're kind of revealing. I think this happened with McAuliffe on Dana Batcher's show, I think. And no, I think they're doing a little self-denial here. The reason they're still talking about Donald Trump's existence and trying to reshape the country into a kind of one-party conservative, Orbanish state, they talk about that. So when Democrats are talking about it, that's the same audience. The mom in Fairfax in Loudoun County who got really organized in 2017 and might be disappointed now, getting her back out. And I saw a little of that happen just talking to voters in Virginia last week. You did hear among Democrats, one of the first things that comes up is that Republicans have gone crazy. I have to vote against Trump, things like that. It is kind of new. And it's some are more blunt about it and say, look, in a typical midterm, even if things are good, you just run on, we did some stuff. People don't turn out. You do need to scare people. So if you want to be despondent about it, it's both parties. I'm not doing a both sides thing. I'm just saying things are so polarized. The demographics of the parties are so set that people say, well, we know about who turned out in 2020. So let's get as many of them out as possible. What does it take? And it turns out Democrats think right now what it takes is reminding them of the Trump role in the party, which I think leaves out a lot. I mean, that leaves them vulnerable because there's just issues that Trump talked about in a kind of unsophisticated way. Like critical race theory is a great example. Trump attacked in 2020. It was kind of haphazard. People didn't know what it meant. Taking that away from Trump and seeing it manifest with all these conservative groups that make it more about, no, your kid, trust me, this is what's happened to your kid. I think Democrats underrated a little bit of how once that became an activist issue, it would change from being a Trump issue. But they can point out, like, this is a Trump issue. This is the people. This is what I think Terry McAuliffe in Virginia is trying to do with mixed success is, yes, you see and hear the people yelling about critical race theory. That is all a Trump made up issue. Don't worry about it. And I think they've kind of tried to wait out the moral panic here and assume that's just not going to be big enough to overwhelm it. But it's way easier to just say, this is the same kind of Trump division, race baiting politics that it's actually gotten him pretty far. He's still ahead in the race despite months of Republicans attacking that issue. I think because it helps them that Trump will occasionally come back and make a comment on Virginia or call into a rally or, put out a statement. I mean, there's a Pavlovian, effect of covering everything he does in the press. So Republicans get asked about it. That Democrats do think that benefits them. And finally, like the tale is that Trump is just not campaigning in these places. Trump is not physically going to the states where these elections are happening because he's not popular and Republicans don't want him to come. And when that's the case, the other party says, okay, well, we know your weakness. You're kind of telling us you don't want us to talk about this gigantic figure in your party who's really unpopular here. Got it. We're going to do that right away.
I mean, that to me seems, I mean, I subscribe and have been saying this for months that they should be running against Trump. I wonder, I'm curious about that. Because you have this dynamic, right? That is in 2018, the Democrats came out in more numbers than the Republicans, even though they both came out in sort of record numbers. More Democrats came out because they could, the only way they could vote against Trump was to vote against Republicans. Mm-hmm. It's not the same relationship when you're coming out trying to vote for Trump that you're voting for Republicans. But they're going to come out and they're trying to make critical race theories distinct from the Trumpism in the party.
Yeah.
How well are the Democrats focusing on Trump? Sometimes I fear that they get too wrapped up in January 6th And we're, you know, speaking on political terms here, so I just want people, before they send me the email about Democrats need to do something. Of course, I think on policy grounds, maybe more so than political grounds, frankly, but certainly to deliver their base, they need to deliver some material benefits so that you get those people. But we're talking about the people who don't, who are low propensity voters. Maybe they'll come out in a general election, but they don't generally come out in these off-year elections unless they can feel like they're voting against Trump. And I wonder if the Democrats aren't focusing. I know the idea is like January 6th is a surrogate for Trump, but I wonder if that surrogate is just too far removed. And if they couldn't just say, like, this guy I'm running against is a Trumpista.
They do say that. They do. I wrote the story. Sorry to talk over it, but and I've talked too much. I'll be quick. But like I wrote the story about
you're here. You tell me the
specifically. Specifically, there are images of January 6th running in TV ads, and Democrat, like, not every Democrat, but Democrats who were on the fence about whether that would be effective. You know, do people forget things 6 months later? They say no. It's awful enough. These images are awful enough. The ongoing story is awful enough that we can use it. But they're being explicit about Trump and Trumpism, and that's really Newsom, Phil Murphy in New Jersey, and Terry McAuliffe all talk the same way, which is, you know, we won, we beat, because all three states, Trump lost them. We did our work, he's gone, but Trumpism is still here. And just the word Trumpism, each one of them has said in some form. In New Jersey, there are, if you go to the really Democratic areas like Newark and Jersey City, there's Democratic Party signs that just say, you know, vote for Murphy, defeat the Trump team. And in Virginia, they McAuliffe campaign has made signs, and there's more to campaigns than signs, but has made signs that are exactly like the Yunkin logo, but they have Trump endorses Yunkin on it in the same font. And that is a trolling. It's the same color, same design, but it is just saying, hey, suburbanites, these guys are exactly like that guy. Don't let them rebrand. They haven't changed at all. And it does remind you more of what Republicans have done effectively with like Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, and say, all right, they're gone, or Hillary Clinton still. I mean, who still appears in campaign ads for Republicans. Right. It is borrowing from the Republicans saying, and I think some of the shift is, look, now that our base has a lot of you know, college educated white voters who were Republican, but now they're Democrats. What is it? And you find this with like the Lincoln Project people, right? That the Lincoln Project people's main issue, because it's the one thing they totally agree with Democrats on, is defending democracy. Trump as a threat. Trump as authoritarian. So as those issues, I feel like they're not the ones that people might, the average person mentions first, but the average person does not vote. Like in an off year election, it's going to be like 40% if you're lucky of people voting. So it's about saying, all right, we're done doing the thing where we have nothing really to run on, just beg you to vote. Here's the villain. Here's the red shirt. We're going to wave it.
What's your sense of how that's going? There's a lot of talk about Virginia tightening and McAuliffe, you know, stumbling. I feel like every time we get close to Virginia, it's the same sort of story. Like, I don't know. It feels like there's a couple of places. It always feels like there's, this is the year Texas is going to go blue, but, and this is the year that, you know, in Virginia, it's going to swing back red. What's your sense of what's going on the ground?
Well, yeah, I think Democrats are running a good campaign. Their turnout in early voting has, they've been winning that, like, less of a landslide than 2020, but bigger than 2017. So they're executing, but their Republicans just are closing out with a couple moral panics, and moral panics are not, also not new to Virginia. Remember, the first race I watched when I was living in Virginia in 2005 was the race for governor and attorney general that year. It was all about child sexual predators. Because the Republican had been attorney general, Republican nominee for governor, and it was, he cracked down on child sexual predators. He was tough on child sexual predators. Well, Democrats let them out of jail. That sort of, that's like the whole children are at risk ethos, or that's been running through campaigns forever. And the current version of it is both in Virginia, the liberals want to teach your kids these crazy things that who knows what they're teaching, and they don't want you to have a say in it. I'm not sure. I'm kind of, you know, la-di-dying it, because it's if you push it, it is stuff like they're being told that America was founded with, you know, on slavery and things like, we don't need to go through a whole 1619 project. It's that, but it's also, there's a case before Loudoun County instituted a open door kind of transgender use the bathroom of your choice. Before they did that, a couple months before, there was a sexual assault that's being investigated that was reported, et cetera, working through the system. The moral panic version of this, Republicans, is thanks to Democrats, loose tolerant policies of these schools. They don't say tolerant. It's happening, people. It's happening. The transgender people are breaking in and committing sexual assault. You've seen that at the close of the campaign. Very familiar. The close of a lot of campaigns is, you know, when in doubt, children are in danger. Children are in danger. Children are going to be sexualized. They're going to be corrupted. They're going to be ruined. And I don't think the Democrats were quite ready to respond to that, because their message is, yes, we're the party that's going to protect children from waste and poverty and COVID-19. We're the keep the schools open with vaccine mandates. Still incredibly popular. Republicans have tried to turn that. And you see in some of the coverage, if people are shorthanding, it's like Youngkin closes on education. And that's been irritating the Democrats. They say, look, literally the first policy that McAuliffe rolled out was a giant education budget. Youngkin took months to come up with anything else. There's much more to education than, are you going to stop them from teaching, you know, Nicole Hannah Jones? There's much more to it than that. But they're not good at it. Like, every time there's a moral panic, very rarely do Democrats to grab the wheel and win. When they do, like they did last, I mean, in Minnesota now, so I'm thinking about it. When they do, like with the racial justice protest last year, they eventually get embarrassed by something and they back out of it. So that's how it's closing in Virginia. Now, just because Republicans, I think, have like hammered this message, they do that every election, right? At this point in 2017, it was that Gillespie was doing a great job seizing the MS-13 sanctuary city issue. 4 years before that, it was that the Obamacare website's failure, that was crashing things. I remember with Tim Kaine, it was what I just mentioned, that the child sexual predators, the death penalty, all these sorts of issues. There's always something that it tightens at the end, and it's like a jump ball. I mean, I feel like if it's a McAuliffe win by a couple of points or a loss by a couple of points, the same message will be like, some of this stuff clearly worked. Democrats clearly turned out some, but not enough of their voters. But it's all, that's really it. Like, they're trying to say the ending of this race is, this is a dangerous Republican Party that can't be trusted, that's really radical, and we're going to just fix the normal things like education. And the Republican message is more of like a moral panic. Things are falling apart, and Democrats are, for your children in particular, Democrats are not going to fix it.
What's going on in terms of, and maybe you don't know, I don't know if you've been down there. This isn't directly associated with the midterms, but I'm curious in terms of like ad deployment, like what is the sort of the rear guard action that like someone like Sinema is taking in Arizona? I mean, because now it seems like she has crossed some type of Rubicon, both in her mind, but also in the greater context that, like, she's not going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party next time around, despite the fact that they seem to have been deploying a bunch of ads saying that she is supporting all the things that she seems to be cutting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Andrew Perez and David Sirota have been doing a good job pointing out who's funding ads in Arizona. There are some progressive group ads there, as there were in West Virginia. Same groups, you know, Building Back Better, these Democratic PACs that were started to help out Biden. They've been running ads, and it's more the kind of pharma groups that stood up these things that say call Sinema and thank her. I don't think the ads are particularly relevant to why she's in the position she's in right now, because she won't tell anybody. I mean, this has been the frustration with Arizonans and reporters, some of whom are Arizonans, is that you kind of hear after the fact what she agreed to, but she's not communicating it in a day-to-day basis. So groups don't know what to do except an overall message of, you're not listening to us. We elected you and you're not doing anything. Why? That's sort of the message, and that's just being funded. Yeah, it's very cookie cutter, the messaging against it. And it might just be, you know, vapor in the wind. I'm not sure that an ad that maybe Sinema is not even watching and that voters might be missing, paid for by pharma, telling voters to thank her for the infrastructure bill, which hasn't been passed yet. I don't know how effective it is, but it's basically a pretty equal amount of money that's going back and forth on the TV.
All right. So, I don't know. I mean, what do you suspect that, I mean, what if McAuliffe wins bigger in Virginia than we had anticipated? Let's say, what if New Jersey is a more resounding victory? Are we going to see the Democrats mm-hmm. go full tilt on Donald Trump and try and sort of, forefront him? I mean, I remember after Obama won, the Obama administration seemed to do this with Rush Limbaugh for a couple of months.
Yeah.
Do you remember that, where they made him
after he said, "I hope he fails," they kind of made him the target.
Made him the face of the party. And your point is, you know, the Clintons, Pelosi, AOC, Republicans always find a boogie. Generally woman, but sometimes man. Democrats never do that. They never seem to be able to do that. And Donald Trump seems to be sort of like turnkey for this.
Yeah, that would be the message, I think. Now, if they win, there's going to be a bunch of stuff that goes into it. But the clear message would be, we spent a lot of money doing what we hadn't done before, which is say, Trumpism's on the ballot. Remember this guy, he wants this guy to win. And they'll say, that definitely worked. I don't think that means that they then don't do anything but run on that in 2022. But they want to get, you know, when they're effective, they're sometimes in Republicans' heads and, you know, tying them to stuff they're not popular running on. And Trump is one of them. So will this work as effectively in, you know, the Kentucky Senate race? I don't think it will. And Charles Booker is not really doing that. But in a Pennsylvania, I think that will encourage Democrats to say, all right, it turns out if people and they'll tell themselves, we don't know what the economy looks like. But I think Democrats generally believe, in talking to the pollsters, things got pretty bad now. The trends of what if the bill is passed and the Fed is right, the deflation's dipping, you know, maybe even if gas is the same price next year and people are used to it, then a lot of those problems are going to go away. We can run on, we're putting things back together, and also Trump's terrible. The COVID part is the hardest one to handle. That's why I'm talking the least about it. But they'll also say, after they said in California, look, being the party of vaccines and mask mandates is a winner, and people need to just stop privileging the people who come and yell and protest about it. I think they already won that argument in California. I don't think it'd be revisited whatever happens next month. I think it would be a question of, did McAuliffe screw up personally in talking about schools and give an opening to Republicans to talk about it nonstop? Because that's really the issue. It's that it wasn't even a mistake. It's what McAuliffe believes, that parents shouldn't be going in and, you know, putting red X's over books they don't like. But it was more that Republicans then spent a month saying that is the issue. That's what's on the ballot. So there'll probably be an investigation of this issue that Democrats, again, in Congress do not care about or not talking about at all. It's not like, even 2009 when Bob McDonnell wins and Chris Christie wins and Republican Democrats in the Capitol are like, oh gosh, this Obamacare is unpopular, isn't it? It wouldn't be that. It'd be, oh, I guess the critical race theory thing, that worked good for them. I don't know. I don't quite know how they react to a loss there. There's, you know, work being done to say any kind of bad result there means they should stop and not do their agenda, you know, not pass the agenda, which is not a thing that anyone actually wants apart from, you know, message makers. You know, if I'm a Republican, I want to win those elections and say it's very clear that Biden has no mandate. Because that's what you say every time you want to stop him doing something. Therefore, he should stop doing all this stuff and go back to unifying the country, i.e. not doing anything. Yeah. I think that's what they will say, but that's, you know, it's not very convincing.
No. Dave Weigel, I want to encourage people to come and check out the trailer so that they can see the stories about the sort of collapsing, if you will, or maybe the narrowing of the potential seats of pickup in the House, but not so much in the Senate. Next time we're on, I want to talk about that. We've got some time, but really interesting to get an update of what's going on the road and what kind of car you're driving when you're on the road. I appreciate
that. It's really weird. I'll send you a link to the YouTube of somebody trying to figure out how to open the car. It takes like 3 minutes.
We'll do that later in the program. Dave, always a pleasure.
Supply chains. Yeah. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you guys.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks, quick break. Be right back. Wrap things up for the week for our Peacock viewers. So there it is, Dave Weigel driving around in some type of utility vehicle, some type of truck. I don't know if he's supposed to be working on the power lines out there. But folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say a goodbye and have a great weekend. And for the rest of you, we'll see you in just a moment. And that moment's now.
Hello.
Super quick. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, but you allow this entire program to survive and thrive. It is your support that makes this show possible. We really appreciate it. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority to get 10% off. And we hope we will see you in Boston. You can buy your tickets now, folks. They are live for everybody. For everybody. Heck, Matt, why don't you tell us what's on the Matt Leckian universe? We're going to stick around. We're not going to go into the fun half yet because we got Jason here and I want to do that. But why don't we just...
Yeah, well, just quick, if you want more content on Joe Biden and why Sleepy Joe sucks, we had Branko Marcetic of Jacobin on to reprise his book, Yesterday's Man, who is our current president. And this weekend, patreon.com/leftreckoning, we'll be talking to Elias Cepeda. We're talking about a few things, Colin Powell, Texas teachers and teaching the Holocaust, and as well as maybe how to reach out to the sports fan community for leftist politics.
So, Cepeda.
Actually, it does... he's more CPD, but okay. But yeah, there you go. Ah. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I couldn't help myself. Just a reminder, too, folks, you can become a member of our Discord community by simply going to majoritydiscord.com and signing up for the Discord. Doesn't cost you anything. Just like our app. Hmm. And I am the show in the fun half of the program. And, of course, you can call the show when we start taking phone calls. And, again, sign up for the AM Quickie newsletter. That's how a lot of folks got their tickets already. And we're going to be doing that more often, like, you know, special things that you're going to get.
Do we have, like, a block of tickets for our friends and family or anything?
This feels like a conversation for off air.
I got an email.
I forgot.
Did you not get that email?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
did you sign up for the
AM didn't. Quickie? I think that's the problem.
Have them sign up.
There you go.
Right.
All right.
This is my memo. I've got to... This, like, I'm being a bad employee, I think.
Tell them to listen for the
I just want to read this. Show. I just saw this. Bilbo Riley is in a fabrication shop in Long Island City pushing a piece of Baltic birch through a table saw with an MR carpenter pencil behind my ear listening to Casual Friday, baby. Whoops, there goes my finger. That Baltic birch, I went to buy not a Baltic birch, just like classically Canadian, plywood. A sheet of plywood is almost $100. It's nuts.
Because of the supply chain issues?
Supply chain issues. Baltic. I mean, I think that's the sixth layer. It's beautiful, beautiful plywood.
Where's Baltic wood from?
I mean, I assume, I don't know where they are, but
the Baltics?
I assume the Baltics. But I don't know. But I've seen some Baltic plywood, and that stuff is beautiful. It really is beautiful.
So, what color is it?
What color is it?
I'm just trying to, like, attempt to engage in this.
Well, now you know how I feel when you start going off about, like, hockey or whatever it is.
Do you want to hear about how the Rangers
won three
road games in a row? Hell yeah.
I'll tell you what I want to do is I want to welcome back to the program the co-host of This Is Revolution podcast. Still connecting to audio. Also, just a great writer.
Now definitely connected.
Jason Miles, are you there?
I am. Oh, reason I have
no camera. Yeah, I was like a voice in the void.
See, for some reason.
Yeah, we see you.
Can you see me?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is that a Conan the Barbarian shirt?
This is a Conan the Barbarian shirt, yeah.
Pretty cool.
That's pretty good. I thought it was a Conan O'Brien shirt, but nevertheless.
No. If I am wearing a Conan O'Brien shirt, there's a problem.
I don't know what is your Medium link? What is if I wanted to tell people to go to your Medium site, what would they do? Just Google Jason Miles Medium?
Yeah, Jason Miles. Let me see. I have it right here. It's jasonmiles.medium.com. Yeah.
Okay. This piece I've been thinking about for 6 weeks almost. You wrote in September, I was a teenage anarchist. Of course, also a title of a song. But it's a great piece. Let's just start. And I've been wanting to talk to you about it and just try and find the right time, because it brings together a lot of sort of my fetishes over the past 20, 25 years, starting off with the Situationists, which was... The Situationist International, if people don't know, came out of the sort of the Latrist movement, and this it was centered in France a little bit, but it was throughout Europe. A guy named Guy Debord was at least the most well known of them, and there was not many of them. There's many people who attribute to them the 68 riots in Paris, and there was only, you know, was largely from them, and they developed all of these sort of like ideas of the spectacle. You can read Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle. You watch a couple of his crazy movies, which I still have on VHS from back in the day. And
you know about Malcolm McLaren being a part of that crew?
Yes. And there was a book called Lipstick Traces, in which I actually, there was a played version with, that guy Urbana, was, I think played Guy Debord in it, back in 2000, went down there. And, much of this I ended up sort of parodying a little bit in the movie called Bad Situation. So this whole world, I really, find fascinating that you start off with things like appropriating advertising messages and repurposing them, and the situations had an idea about architecture and urban planning that was
not much, you know. Only guys like Mike Davis really got into stuff like architecture and urban planning when he writes I can't think of the name of the
City book. Of Quartz.
Yes, City of Quartz, about California. And then you know, when you think about a guy like Malcolm McLaren and you think about the Sex Pistols, for me personally, and I don't know if you know this, because I've only interacted with you like this. You were on Ben Burge's show and we were both guests, and then Pascal and I were on. So you might not know, I actually am a musician. Me doing this show comes out of something I wanted to do right before COVID. And then it was going to be something we did. The band thought it was a dumb idea. something we did when we weren't touring, because I toured a lot. And so that's where this comes from. So I actually lived in a warehouse in West Oakland. If you're familiar with the movie Sorry to Bother You, a lot of that was shot there. But in this warehouse where these bands practiced and recorded, the Flipper was in there. The Dead Kennedys would come by so often. Faith No More is there. Then all the 80s metal bands are there. And then everything hip hop from the Bay Area is done out of there as well. So I kind of had my outlook on a lot of the things I see. And if you read the piece, a lot of it is really about the online left.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that was the sort of, that's a spoiler alert. It comes in, and I was just reading the piece. I don't know how, I can't remember exactly how I came across it. And I was just reading it from the perspective of looking at the relationship. And, you know, so much of it is like sort of like a Gen X sort of centered type of experience of music. And so let's go through that, because I love the way that you talk about this music in relationship to what was happening politically. And then ultimately where we get to this idea of both, of its deconstruction. And hold on, let me get to my notes here. It's a culture of deconstruction banging up against the culture of authenticity is where all this is leading. Mm-hmm. And, these are all very big issues for those of us who sort of were in our 20s and in Gen X in the 90s. And let's take it from Nirvana, because I remember when Nirvana came on tour with the Nevermind album. This is the one that everybody knows. I don't know. I guess everybody did.
I was obsessed with it, even though I was born in the same year he died after that.
The people I was friends with go down to see Nirvana at the Middle East in Cambridge.
I played the Middle East.
Okay. And so you know that scene there. And there was like people were bummed because like we were listening to Bleach, which was their end, but the idea that they were getting this level of fame was really irritating to everybody. And I was like, why would we be upset about that? Don't we want? And there was this sort of, so work maybe backwards from that.
Hold on for a second, brother Cedar. Let's backtrack a little bit in this. let's talk about before Nirvana, and you cannot have Nirvana without Black Flag, right? One thing I write in the piece that I'm probably going to get shit for, as more people are going to read it now that I'm on the Majority Report, is that I don't look at grunge as a genre more than a fashion aesthetic, because genres tend to have a sonic through line. And a lot of those bands just happen to be from Seattle and they happen to be on Sub Pop, but there was really no similarity in sound, because Alice in Chains, in my opinion, comes more from Van Halen and the hair metal scene of the 80s, and maybe even Black Sabbath, than Nirvana, which is like, you know, that first wave of U.S. hardcore with bands like Flipper. I mean, Chris Novoselic goes off once Kirk dies and joins Flipper and gets Flipper their first ever major label deal. So when you look at bands that come from that first wave of hardcore, they are the American spawn of what they saw coming out of the UK.
Yep.
But the UK is the derivative of what they were getting from the States with bands like the Dolls, the New York Dolls, the Ramones, Television, et cetera, et cetera. And the UK gives you the visual aesthetic. And that's, to me, where the situationalist element comes into play. Malcolm McLaren knew how to sell spectacle. But one thing about the Sex Pistols that we don't really talk about when we talk about punk music, whether you like them or not, it, to me, isn't the point, is that it was accessible music. It's not that off-putting. There's songs you can sing along to. I mean, your show literally starts off with the last line they ever say as a band in my hometown, San Francisco. You ever get the feeling you've been cheated because of that horrible tour where he had this great idea. I'm going to take the circus on the road in the middle of America. And those guys hated it. And they were also addicted to drugs. I don't know if you've ever been on tour with a drug addict. It's not a party. It's a nightmare.
Right.
I can't get dope in certain parts of the country. It's a bigger fucking nightmare. So now you got like dope sick dudes that are trying to drink themselves into playing. And then you also, McLaren took out people that could play in that band just to have the spectacle of Sid Vicious. And that's why I do start it off with a quote from Sid Nancy. You know, I don't know if Malcolm McLaren really said that shit in the studio, but I think that really explains that. So,
and we should say about them that one thing that I find also interesting, that was also a situation, was that they were building in the critique of them not being good musicians, essentially. Like, that was part of the package.
You didn't need to be good, right? You're the antithesis of major 70s rock, which is kind of funny because we're in an era where major 70s rock is getting a bit of a comeback. What's that shitty band that everybody likes that sounds like Led Zeppelin? I can't think of their name. They played at Coachella a few years ago, and I worked there doing like number shit, and everybody was all...
Wolf Mother?
No, that's another shitty band that sounds like other bands. They're newer. I can't think of their name, but they sound like Led Zeppelin, like a total Led Zeppelin ripoff, and everybody loved it. But there is an element of classic rock that's even back in the quote unquote underground genres where people.
Greta Van Fleet.
Greta Van Fleet, yeah, yeah. Oh God, just
credit to Bradley on that one, yeah.
You hella made me remember that whole fucking Coachella, but That's another topic for another time, Sam. The nightmare of an old man like me working young people festivals.
I mean,
worse or better than when Sam thought your shirt was a Conan O'Brien shirt.
Right, there you go.
Yeah.
It's 1A and 1B.
There you go.
Sorry, where were we?
Sorry. Yes.
Well, so you, I mean, we're talking about the failure of the people in Sex Pistols.
Okay.
The perception that they were bad musicians and
The reality that they were bad musicians.
The musicianship didn't need to be there. Passion needed to be there. And so there's this culture with the fans of violence, right? Spitting on people becomes part of the show. That's weird to me. Still something that I wouldn't say the spitting part, but violence at shows in these scenes that definitely live in the culture of deconstruction is still a thing. One of the last shows I played in a place called San Bernardino, California, there's a thing called crowd killing for these kids that do this thing called hardcore dancing, where even if people don't want to be a part of your mosh pit, they'll still fucking bring you in and hit you and shit like that. I think I fucked up. And I said, when I got on, I was like, look, I'm not from around here. We don't play that shit. We will fuck you up if you try to, you know, started a whole conversation about it, which was kind of funny to do from the stage. But that shit's just not cool to me. But that becomes part of the allure for some. And also, we're talking about a youth that is now not a part of any sort of movement. So we're the 60s, from soul music to rock music to folk music, is really about fighting these greater causes. Racism, sexism, and the biggest one, the war in Vietnam. How many songs do we have from legendary artists from that era about the war in Vietnam, right? This is the common cause. And when we think about that era, what are the images that we think back to outside of Woodstock? We think of the girl putting the flower in the gun. We think of hippies against soldiers.
Kent State, all sorts of protests.
Panthers.
What do we think? By the time we get to the 80s, to be clear, by the time we get to the 80s, we have also gone through the, at least in terms of the way society told the story, that within the course of 10 years, there was almost this sort of like complete rejection of the yippie counterculture, and it was replaced with yuppies by that point in the early 80s. And so there was just sort of like you were untethered as to if you were caught in between those two forces, it seemed to me.
Well, and a lot changes economically, right? Now we're starting to make this pact with China, and we're moving factories overseas, and the economic opportunities that your parents just had to buy a home. They're buying a home before the 30-year mortgage is a thing. That's how cheap home buying is at this point in time. They can not have a college degree or even a high school diploma and buy said home and raise a family. Now, that is not your reality as a young man or woman in the 70s in the UK, especially once Thatcher comes in with crazy austerity politics and coming out of Carter's administration, which is maybe the beginning of the neoliberal era for a lot of people. Reagan poses a massive threat, and that becomes the rallying cry for this movement of American hardcore. And I want to bring this up because I think we can't really talk about where Nirvana comes from until we talk about where their influence comes from and why Nirvana is really interesting to me. And where Nirvana is interesting to me is I did do some research in doing this. I am friends with some of these artists from this era. And I also, through doing my show and knowing a bunch of cool rock and roll punk rock professors, there's more than you think there are out there. They were actually part of the scene that actually went to school with some of these bands and started bands as well. There was a few things that I wanted to ask them about the scene in particular. And my main question was about 84 being a seminal year, because that's Reagan's reelection year. And that's the year they're defeated. And if you go back and look at the flyers from that era, there's some really great art from that era. And you listen to the music of that era, it's all anti-Reagan. And it's all about, you know, being mad at your conservative parents and not wanting to be part of the bourgeoisie that you are kind of born into. You could pretty much call that music fuck you mom music if you really, if you really wanted to. And 84, they lost. And then the music gets a little more violent. And the fan base gets a little more violent. It almost looks a little fashy. And there's a great documentary, and it's an awesome coffee table book called American Hardcore, which has some really beautiful imagery of that era. If you like that type of music, I think the imagery is beautiful in it. And the documentary is pretty interesting. If you just want to know about, you know, origins of some of these bands and the music and what was making them want to do this stuff and how they were touring. But what happens is I think people get so caught up in what they think the story is about these guys that they're kind of projecting on them a leftist tendency that might not be there in everybody. And a lot of the article for me poses a question. Are these guys really trying to create something outside of the mainstream? Or were you just locked out of the mainstream? And this is kind of a cottage industry that's formed by you being locked out. By the time Nirvana comes to be, because remember, as Sam can attest, as everybody else that's on the screen that I see is probably born in the 90s, as Sam can attest, these bands all had to like make their own flyers. There is no terrestrial radio. There is no online.
It's all college radio for a lot of these bands.
College radio is king. I came up in an era where college radio was king. Self-pressing was huge. Because again, people now can kind of record a record on your laptop, and there's distribution sites that'll distribute it for you on every major platform. Before, just getting to be able to record your music was the challenge. So that's why the recordings from that era are really bad, because you're talking about we had to sneak in at this time to do this. Da, da, da. And it becomes where the worse the recording, the more authentically real you are, because it's all about energy. The Germs to me are a perfect example of that. The Germs, I don't know anyone that walks around singing Germ songs. I'm not saying they're bad songs. It's just they're really badly recorded. they the singer died, I think, after the first record, sadly killed himself. And it's not that catchy. By the time Nirvana decides to sign a major label deal, you know, we always have to add that caveat, they sign a major label deal. I don't think anyone in that camp knew how big Nevermind was going to be, because also they're coming out in the shadow of not just hair metal. And I didn't really add this too much in the piece, but you're also coming out of the shadow of an emergence of heavy metal. You know, bands like Metallica are going platinum. Megadeth are going platinum. Iron Maiden is a huge stadium act. Ozzy Osbourne's a huge stadium act. And then you have the hair bands, which are kind of a more Reagan-esque, decadent catnip for suburban mall youth at that time. So Nirvana's Nevermind, I'm sure they thought it was going to do well, but they never thought it was going to do what, like 11 plus million copies, influencing people like Emma Vigeland, you know, years later.
Well, and I feel like they also, there was an element, maybe this is just my own bias, but they were also a, came out of like the tradition of like Husker Du and the Replacements in particular. Like, I mean, the Replacements for me was, that was it for me. Like And Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash is exactly like one of those albums, like, and they're building into that critique, right? Like, this is the garbage that we actually put on. I'm not sure how well they could all play, frankly, and certainly not after an entire bottle of vodka. Could Westerberg stay up on stage? It seemed, It felt like Nirvana was a sort of a hybrid of those sort of garage band post punk. I don't know how else to place the Replacements in there. And that sort of the metal on some level.
I wouldn't necessarily call them post punk. I think they are a part of punk. I've also played with a lot of those post punk bands. I'm talking like the first wave English late 70s bands. So I don't put them in that category because I don't think they are post-punk. I think if anything, they are the Clinton punk, if you will. But ultimately it becomes important music to the journalists that are writing about it. And no matter what Kurt Cobain tries to do to shed this pop culture fame, it just becomes more and more marketable. It's, there's some Mark Fisher quotes in the piece, because Fisher actually wrote about Nirvana. He was a music journalist as well as a great writer with Capitalist Realism. And I think his critique of Cobain, the paradox of his fame, that and drug addiction had a lot to do with his suicide, because the thing about the culture of authenticity is you're constantly kicking people out, like you said earlier, that get a certain level of fame because they're not real. And we see it here as well on the online left, right? And these two cultures, the culture of deconstruction, which is basically just the culture of no. That's it. We had Vijay Prashad on our show one day, and we were talking about the contemporary, mostly online left, let's speak realistic. And he goes, you just can't be no all the time. Mm. He said, you have to give people something to want to fight for. We've had Shahid Buttar. I'm friends with Shahid Buttar. He's like, we've critiqued enough. We need solutions. This music doesn't give you solutions. It's not supposed to give you solutions, because you have authenticity on one side and you have deconstruction on the other side. And they're working hand in glove to pretty much keep the scene very, very small. There's really no infrastructure built in to propel anybody into the mainstream to try to deconstruct the mainstream, because that's not really a goal.
I mean, let's move into that, to that parallel with the online left, because this is where you sort of take that turn. And, you know, like, from my perspective, like with the Squad, for instance, we're looking at politicians who are bringing stuff from the outside into the halls where there's institutional power. And of course, that's going to mean, like, you got to do the music video that MTV, like, you know, like, to sort of like cross it. They're going to do that video. And that is, they're doing that music video so that they can expand their base and bring that music to a different audience. I mean, that to me feels like what, you know, where we have been at. And on some level, those people who were pissed about Nevermind, that I, you know, down at the Middle East, that it was getting so much attention, that's sort of the stage that we've been in since Bernie's loss in 2020 on some level, which is like, let's just tear it down for the most part. And if it's not it that we're tearing down, it's just like, let's train that fire all around us on some level. And nothing's being constructed, and nothing, like, you know, I think there's been a massive failure by the Democratic leadership, let's say, for pushing a lot of these, you know, in the way that they tried to sell this big bill. But there has been a shocking absence of any type of organization, not just with the online left. I think, like, sort of broadly speaking, of like, where are the people advocating for? I mean, free community college is not free college, but it's free community college. Where are the people advocating for parental leave? Where are the people? Like, where is this happening?
This gets into deconstruction, right? Because then you hear people say shit like this. How many times have you guys said this? And Matt, please jump in if you hear me on this. It's not enough. A little social democracy in America would go a long fucking way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Please don't call me a reformist. I'm just being realistic. When I was working a regular job before the fame and riches of podcasting, I worked with the unhoused. A little bit of social democracy goes a long fucking way. When Gavin Newsom goes, and it wasn't his decision because he was sitting in a room and figured, I figured it out. When he got pushed by activists to use vacant hotels to house homeless people, you got the COVID numbers down. We got to house people in their own individual units with their own showers. Were there problems with it? Hell yeah. Did I have to fucking stop dudes from beating the shit out of their women? Hell yeah. Did I see kids that had dropped out of school in the second grade that couldn't read? Hell yeah. There's problems. But the first step has to be the housing. But if I poo-poo the project as a massive failure, you know, it didn't work out as well in LA as it did in the Bay Area, then it's hard to get anything done.
And how much of that, too, is just this internalized, I don't want to say trauma, but yeah, trauma, I guess, throughout society, that trying or working hard and taking these steps of progress, that's harder than just saying tear it all down. And it opens you up, like, emotionally, and it opens your hopes up to something that might not work out and might let you down.
And what happens when the machine, and the machine in this sense is capitalism, how do you fight the machine when you, as my co-host who's been on this show, Pascal Robert, says, there is no left in America. We have a bunch of leftists. And the left doesn't have enough power to pop a fucking grape. So what happens when you elect powerless people into state and federal office when there's no true infrastructure there to support them? There's no grassroots movements outside of maybe some sort of electoral movement to really push any sort of agenda. You will get consumed by the machine, right? Kurt Cobain could have stayed on Sub Pop. Nirvana could have stayed on Sub Pop. I don't know that they sell 11 million records with that exact same album, Nevermind. Because remember, that was done on Sub Pop. But they break out into the mainstream and there's really no infrastructure there to support them other than the mainstream infrastructure. And even when we look at these cultures of authenticity in the underground, they're literally modeled off the bigger capitalist ones. Why does SST lose all those bands? Because they're not paying the fucking bands. You know who else doesn't pay bands? Major labels.
Right.
So, as I'm watching people fight, I'm asking myself, is your fight a legitimate frustration or is it a brand exercise? Because much like these bands from the 80s, when the 90s hit and this genre called pop punk came to be, Green Day, Blink 182, maybe you can throw bands like Rancid in. And again, these are some people that I personally know, and I'm not saying this as a pejorative. But and I don't think they said, hey, guys, we're like punk, but like not frightening. Like, I don't think that was their goal, because to them, they are just like those 80s bands, because those 80s bands come out of suburban nuclear families as well. Right. But the fame that they get, because after Nirvana, you get Dookie. And it's like, dude, we can monetize rebellion. You start to get the blow up of Hot Topic stores where Sam, I believe, a teenage daughter.
I do.
I have a 23-year-old daughter, but I do have teenage boys. And
you also see Kristen Sinema on a regular basis, right? She seems to shop at Hot Topic.
No, that's what's the older version? There's like an older version of Hot Topic. Wet Seal?
I don't know. Not exactly sure.
Is Wet Seal still a thing? But you know what I mean? Like, you can get rebellion at Hot Topic. When I saw an Anarchy shirt for sale, I was like, word? That was something that you made. And when you even watch, like Cobain made a flipper shirt. That was his favorite band, but he couldn't get one. Because they didn't mass produce merchandise. Those guys were all fucking dope fiends trying to just get to the next town. So when you see this stuff blow up and mall culture blow up and these original dudes are sitting by, they're like, punk is dead. F these guys. They're playing these big festivals. Warped Tour is a corporate festival. Vans is a major corporation. It's owned by another company. I can't think of the name off the top of my head. Please don't think there's some stoner in a garage making slip-on checkerboard Vans. They are part of a major, major multinational conglomerate. So these guys are seeing the aesthetic they created, selling millions of records, playing bigger rooms. Eventually, they start getting on Warped Tour. Warped Tour's got an old fucking band stage. There's a name for it. I can't think of the name for it. You know. And now these guys are getting their own edition of Vans. There's a Bad Brains Vans edition, right? You can go into a Hot Topic right now with your teenage daughter, and she can go run to the anime / Hot Topic band section, and there is a section for Sam Cedar with Minor Threat shirts that you never got to get as a young person, right? Yeah, bill collector. Sorry.
I mean that was like the. I mean, to a certain extent, there's a situationist. This is the situationist. Sort of like the spectacle just absorbs everything ultimately, and there is no ability to sort of stand outside of it. And there was this concept, particularly around the 90s, I think it was, when I remember Mort Saul actually was talking about there is no selling out anymore. It's just you're buying in. You can't stand outside of that machine on some level. And then it becomes largely a branding exercise because you don't know how to both express the frustration, but you also well, I want somebody to hear me express my frustration, so I've got
I want to play in a room full of people. Look, man, you did comedy. You're doing comedy for the bartender.
Well, yeah, actually, I did for a very long time. In fact, that's probably
sucks. Well, and you're friends with David Cross. David Cross is one of my favorite comedians. If it wasn't for David Cross, I wouldn't even know that this show existed. I saw David Cross in this show hella years ago, and I was like, oh, this is his comedy review show. And I found out it wasn't.
But, there was many times I performed comedy for the bartender and David Cross. And until Cross would just literally physically mess with me on stage to impress the bartender. And that was basically it. I mean, there was maybe four or five other people.
You get more free drinks.
Right. I mean,
you already are given.
But the point being, at one point, that becomes unsatisfying. Right. Like at one point, you need to have an audience
in front of people. And the thing is, when you get to a certain point, there's a great interview for people watching the show. There's a really good interview with Henry Rollins in like 86. It's somewhere in the middle of the country. I want to say he's in like Dearborn, Michigan. And the kid interviewing them after the show is basically trying to say, are you guys sellouts now because you grew your hair long and you slowed the music down? So around the record, this record called My War by Black Flag, the most punk rock thing they can do is like slow shit down. We're going to grow our hair out, partially because why the fuck not? We're always gone. We don't have time to fucking look cute for you. And Rollins is kind of a douche in the interview to this young kid, but it's again that culture of authenticity, like, oh, you sold out now because you played in front of, you know, maybe a few thousand people, which isn't that big when you think about it, because that was the max that those guys really got. They never played arenas.
Right.
Never. And It's real interesting as Rollins is kind of trying to make the kid say, well, tell me why I'm a sellout. No, what about me is selling out? We're dirty. We have no money. And we're going to spend it trying to get to the next goddamn city. So what about me is selling out? And when you look at the online left, and certain people are sellouts and this, that, and the third. It's like, well, why are they sellouts? What is making this person a sellout? Is it you don't like what they have to say? Is it that you think they're trying to get on MSNBC? Because I got bad news for people. That shit ain't easy to get on MSNBC. You can't just go down there and be like, I want to get on MSNBC. Right?
You really need somebody who they want on to leverage you on. That's basically what happened with me. I wanted Janine on, and she said, I'll come on if Sam comes on with me. That's basically how I started my career to get onto that place. But that's happens very rarely.
Very, very rarely. But it's hella easy for people to call you a sellout for trying to get your message out to a broader audience. But it's also very easy to get co-opted by trying to get to a broader audience. And so why I brought all that stuff up about the 90s and pop punk is these bands that were saying punk is dead later start playing the corporate festivals. They start getting corporate endorsements. Some of them get major label deals. Some of them, if they had a little independent label, it got bought out by a major. So they are the facade that is the undergroundness of the major label that's running everything. And you start to ask yourself, are you raging against the machine? Or are you raging to be a part of the machine? Or does the machine just consume you?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, I mean, we don't have, and we have not had, a counterculture in this country since the 80s. And I think I first sort of like, and maybe before then, but certainly I saw it in the context of, you know, or in the early 90s with this sort of rise of independent film, and I was a Cassavetes fan, and I realized just, you know, and I had done a very low budget film at that time, and realized, like, even going around, that unless somebody's film had gotten bought, mm-hmm, I didn't care about it either. like mine wasn't bought. And I was like, I knew it wasn't, you know, a masterpiece, but I knew, like, it had some value, but there was no counterculture. There was no place where this could be seen, even at the festivals, as the festivals became markets as opposed to exhibition, you know, like circuits of exhibition, they became markets. And I was like, you know, if I'm talking to somebody and they tell me their film hasn't sold after playing at two or three festivals, my immediate reaction is, can't be good.
Film sucks.
Can't be good. And even though I knew that, like, that was exactly the case with my movie at the time, and I didn't think that my movie was garbage, but I, like, would catch myself sort of having that immediate reaction, because at one point, and it was probably during the 80s, this concept of, if it has no commercial viability, it is not, there is no support mechanism. There is no system in which it can be valued, because there was a time in our society where, like, there were infrastructures and support systems, mm-hmm, and compensation, not in the form of money, but in terms of, like, esteem, or you could get, you could get famous in circles.
You could get a film made.
Commercial success.
You could show it. You could show it at bars and underground places and art houses. You kind of see a little bit of that now, right? Because there's just a ton of film festivals for everything. But on a larger scale, let's pull back a little bit and look at this from a larger scale. Again, using pop culture. Two humongously successful movies, financially and critically, is Nomadland, which is a horrible take on a good book, and Parasite. Snowpiercer, which is a very anti-capitalist movie by the same person that did Parasite, is a TV show we can sell anti-capitalism?
Well, it was a movie first, right? I mean, I have seen the movie. I don't know what the TV show's like, but I can't imagine that it's like more edgy than what
it's, it's like the prequel, right? It's the, remember this, the frozen people on the side, and they're like, those were the big. But again, this is the most anti-capitalism, ham-fisted movie around Snowpiercer, right? Yeah. Poor people in the back, they are the fodder for the engine. If I'm spoiling anything for you, that movie's been out for like 5 years. You should have watched it. Parasite, another great movie about class and capitalism. The Joker, a very anti-neoliberal movie where Batman's family are the villains. The rich people are the villains in this movie. And these are massive, major Hollywood productions. And again, and I bring this up because it's back to that machine situation. Does it just consume you when there really is no infrastructure and there really is no vision to see how I can get through to the mainstream? Because one thing about the culture of deconstruction and the culture of authenticity is it never has an entryway into the mainstream to deconstruct the mainstream so you can have your utopian world, right? And then you have so many people that have grown up in an era of reality television and branding that one of the main occupations that younger people want to have is influencer.
Right.
Have you ever been around a bunch of influencers? Shit sucks.
Well, that, I mean, that is, I mean, there's some really good writing about how that was around, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago about the Facebook and Instagram essentially teaching people to commodify themselves. And I mean, to the point where now it almost seems like, well, yeah, no, of course. Like, mm-hmm. Is that controversial? And is what's wrong with that? I mean, to the point where like there was a time almost probably less than a decade ago where that was sort of controversial. Do you really want to commodify yourself and get, you know, put yourself in the, you know, I've earned, my, being has earned a certain amount of likes today. And, you know, that was, nuts. But all right. Well, listen, I would love to continue this conversation because, it fascinates me, and I can't encourage people to read, your piece, enough. And, you know, maybe we can sort of like move on to the implications of where it leaves the online left even more.
That's the next piece that I'm working on because my big fear is I shouldn't say fear, but what I'm starting to notice is that this is just a branding exercise. Mm. Ultimately, that's all it becomes.
What, the online left or yes, I mean I think so much of it. You know, and maybe there's a certain inevitability. My perspective on like what, you know, from and I entered into it before it would, there was an online left. Actually, it was just.
I'll say this on air because I want to put you on the spot. We did send you an email because we want to get you on the show to talk about.
Your early days in America and the idea of a leftist mainstream. I will do. I cannot tell you how far behind I am on such things. But I think that, like, you know, the what was, at least in my mind when I entered in, and it was a different medium, and so there was, it functioned in a different way, and it could function in a different way, was to amplify people who didn't have access to, you know, I'm on mass radio. We're on in LA. We're on in New York. We're on in Chicago. We're on in Miami and Dallas. In 8 of the top 10 markets in the country. And from Chris Hayes to Glenn Greenwald to Chalmers Johnson to whoever it was, it's like, we have the ability to actually amplify voices, that are important voices, and that was what our function was. But then when everybody is in on a platform where everybody has the same sort of like, you don't need 10 stations, you don't need a tower, you're also not going to reach, unless you're one of those rare people, you know, millions of people on a daily basis, then it becomes like, well, what is the function of this? You know, if you're not, how much are you going to be able to amplify people? And if you're not able to amplify people, what is, how do you, like, you know, there's a lot more questions to it, but when are you going to be done with that piece, man?
I got it. I always run this stuff by Pascal.
Let's go.
And I always have to run it by Ture Reed. So I have to run everything by those, the council of great thought. And once the council approves it, then I can post it up. But that is the next piece. And also I have to get off these dating apps. That's really what's happening right now.
I hear you on both. Maybe that'll be the third piece that you write and we can talk about that. We'll do the whole series. We're going to put a link to your Medium piece. Jason Miles, can't tell you how much I really appreciate this conversation and the piece itself, I mean, frankly. It really is. I found it really interesting.
Well, and if you ever make it back to California during the plague, I will make it a point. I'm not in the Bay Area right now. I'm transitioning to move out of the country, but I will make it a point to come back and take you to the studio in Oakland. And I guarantee whatever day we go in, you will see someone you grew up watching.
Oh, that's awesome.
We'll have a
folks, check out this Is Revolution podcast as well. Jason Miles, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Folks, I guess it's going to be Freebie Friday. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to tell you. Boy, we just give.
It's very punk.
This is how you maintain your legitimacy.
This is how I maintain the authenticity.
I'm going to be going handing out copies of the Majority Report today out of the trunk of my car.
Yes. There you go. Sure. And that's also why you didn't cut your hair, coincidentally.
I mean, I it's been a while. Since, every
or you
now
cut
and then,
your own hair.
Every now and then, yes. Not with a razor blade, though.
Yes, with paper
when
scissors.
When I was in high school, that was what you would do if you were a punk. You would cut your hair with a razor blade.
Why does it have to be a razor blade? Because it's
don't
just
know.
Like a Sweeney Todd
authenticity.
Thing. Yeah, no. Do not know. I just saw this just popped up. Peter Scolari died. He was an actor on Bosom Buddies. But I had known this guy. He was a director, and we did a couple of plays together.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I did some play reads for him. Nice guy. Rest in peace. It's really, really sad. All right. I don't know if we're going to have time to...
Take calls
now. We'll see. We may go a little bit long today. Let's do a... what's one of these videos that we should
do? Let's do the lady who talked about the prayer she spoke. I think maybe is it the last one, Bradley?
Yes.
13? Okay, yeah.
This is, I think, just a little bit of viewpoint diversity from Majority
Report.
Yeah,
exactly. We want to do all sides. We report, you decide.
This person is speaking in front of a Turning Point USA banner, you'll notice.
Yes, this is a Republican candidate for Secretary of State, Rachel Hamm. She is running for California, Secretary of State. And,
well, it's a lot.
Let's listen to this first.
We were staying in a hotel, and my parents were staying here with our children. And I am a prophetic dreamer. That means I see things in my dreams before they happen. God speaks to me through my dreams. He shows me things. So I wake up in an Irvine hotel, and I have just had a dream that someone has tried to break into my home, murder me, and light my house on fire. Okay, so I wake up and I'm like, my heart's beating, I'm sweating, you know. So I wake up and I pray. And I use my authority in Jesus' name to say, no, no one is going to break into my home or murder me or light my house on fire or harm me in any way in Jesus' name. And I pray and I do what I know to do and I get a peace and I go back to sleep. I wake up in the morning and I call home and my mom says, who's standing right here, you are not going to believe what happened last night. You know the witches, the self-proclaimed witches who lived two doors down? Well, someone broke into their house, murdered her, and lit the house on fire. Now, I, of course, was like, excuse me? What did you just say? Now, something you should know, that part of using your authority in Jesus' name is when I was praying against what I saw in my dream, I said, if anyone has sent that to me, if someone has intended to break into my house and kill me and light my house on fire, then I not only will not receive that, but I'm sending it right back to them in Jesus' name. Okay, well, I didn't even know how much authority I had in that situation until I called my mom and found out that the very thing that I had just dreamed that someone was trying to do to me had happened to them.
Yeah, she's like so moved by the fact that her neighbor was murdered instead of her.
Sorry, it wasn't just any neighbor, it was her witch neighbor.
Right, yes. Self-proclaimed witch. Maybe it was Christine Quinn.
And I would just say, if somebody is doing
something...
No, that's
not her, right? What was the name of that woman who said, I'm not a witch? Yeah. Oh, okay.
But if you are conversing with your God and having that God kill people, I have some questions about whether you're a witch or not, personally, but that's just me.
Right. I mean, dying in a fire. Look, this is just a test case in magical thinking, which is like exactly
we're sort of burying the lead here, okay. Right? Like, I mean, how do you, as a California voter... not vote for someone with this kind of power? And why does she even need to campaign at this point? I mean, she has the ability to literally reverse a witch's curse and have it go back on them and have God slay them.
Jesus.
Well, through the power of Jesus.
Yeah.
And first of all, you don't want this person Secretary of State? Let's make her governor,
well,
for God's sakes.
I do. I question.
This is the President of the United States we should be talking about. Like, just think what we could do with, like, working about, like,
stock market or stuff?
Stock market, or just bring her down to Long Beach and get those boats in here and get these containers across the country. Let's do this.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, because it does seem like a very powerful power, but she doesn't seem to understand it terribly well. She needs to go through, like, X-Men school and sort of learn how to understand her
harness
dreams.
She needs to harness her opponent, yeah. But exactly. It doesn't seem like she can control what she dreams, right? She didn't seem
to
be able to...
No, she's receiving stuff. She's not making this
that's
up.
That's my
this
point.
Is
so
real.
She's just a vessel, and she will go wherever her dreams and where Jesus tells her to go.
No, but she also
murder
has the ability...
Whoever,
she has the ability to deflect certain things that come at her and to go the other way.
Yeah, Jesus, I know you had me scheduled for getting in a car accident today. Can you please give that to somebody else?
I really
Let me ask you this, though. Okay. Let me ask you this. Let's just say, and I don't want anybody to, like, make assumptions about me in this instance, but let's just say you did have this power. Let's say, for instance, that, like...
Just hypothetically.
Let's just say, hypothetically, like, you dream one night that, like, some dude is going to try and get you fired from his job, from your job, by digging up an old tweet.
Right.
And you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, by the power of Abraham and Moses and Isaac and Jacob, I reverse... You're digging up that tweet, throw it back on you, and so that you're going to end up being humiliated online. Let's say you had the ability to do it. Would you really tell people about it? Wouldn't you play it close to the vest?
Yeah.
Maybe you bring it up a couple years later in the context of, like, a description of, like, an analogy about something.
She might be
But you would never, in the moment, tell people.
She might be trying to get ahead of the story a little bit here. Because sounds like she might have just sleptwalked and murdered her neighbor. I mean, not saying that she did
that's
it.
That's another thing. It's like, I'm like, is this an alibi?
Right.
Like, I was asleep in an Arizona
exactly.
hotel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was the witch's curse that, or it was Jesus's smiting that I reversed. No. She reversed the witch's curse onto the witch with the power of Jesus.
Now,
maybe, I don't know, is that manslaughter?
I mean, I wouldn't want to take total credit for that in public unless I was outside the window of statute of limitations. But the other part about this that is a little bit disturbing is not only am I convinced that we will have elected officials like this who are high placed soon, I'm not convinced that we haven't already had elected officials like this.
Yes.
They just maybe are a little bit more circumspect with the how open they are.
Like Mike Pence.
Yes.
Mike Pence.
Reagan's.
And I mentioned it was not Christine Quinn, it's Christine O'Donnell.
Christine Quinn ran in New York.
Right.
That's correct. That was, I missed it by that much. Wow. That's something. Let's play a little Crowder, shall we? Steven Crowder, how old is that kid? Do you know how old he is? 30
in his 30s.
34 34-year-old man baby that is so masculine he needs to show how masculine it is by constantly working out, getting his big muscles, and then on top of that wear a penis enhancer in a holster.
Oh.
That he wears on his chest.
When he isn't dressing up like a woman. And I believe a few days ago he posted some photo of him with a tube of lipstick. And
oh, well, he showed them, didn't he?
He's just trying to be a
he
manly man.
He showed all
man.
Those people. There is... I don't know what I think is like more reprehensible. The idea that this guy... will be racist and homophobic and transphobic and misogynist for money, or that I actually believe that he does this when they're off air too.
Mm.
But here he is. This is just, when somebody sent me this, I was like, what? What is wrong
I was
with
like,
this dude?
I was like thinking, like, we do enough Crowder is a bigot content, but this is just like,
he's just like, this is a...
it's so gratuitous that the guys also in the studio are like, whoa, hold, like, cool, pump the brakes.
Yeah, wait, we're
which
live.
Is not, that yeah. doesn't happen
this is the group
often.
Chat.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
This is in our intercompany Slack.
Yeah. He's trying to get banned, is my opinion, but
yeah, let's see.
We'll see.
San Francisco In-N-Out, they've been in a battle with the city over... let me just let them tell you the story. Vaccine requirements.
Brian, right now,
ooh,
this
that
Fisherman's
is an aggressively Asian face.
Is open, but only
it is
for to-go orders. Take a look
a
at that
it'd
sign
be like
on the
black
door.
Diamond.
Says
you have to
indoor
drop it
dining is unavailable at this time, and that's because the city's Department of Public Health.
Now, let's just be clear. He's doing, of course, like, you know, he's doing celebrating the anti-vaccine mandate requirement for public places, in the same way that I'm sure he spent a lot of time when it was down on the, you know, can't wear shoes and shirts in you have to wear shoes and shirts in the In-N-Out. Like, I'm surprised In-N-Out like stands for that. Why can't they let their clients come in without shirts and shoes? But nevertheless, and then he sees the image of this woman and is like, it's an aggressively Asian face. Like, what demented, like, what, just play that over again. And then what does he say after that? Like, his producer is like, whoa, slow down, chief.
Then he mutters something that's hard to pick up.
Yeah.
Diamond or something.
But play from the beginning.
San Francisco In-N-Out, they've been in a battle with the city over, let me just let them tell you the story, vaccine requirements.
Brian, right now,
oh,
this
that is an aggressively Asian face.
Is open, but only it is for to-go orders. Take a look at that sign on the door. It says indoor dining is unavailable at this time, and that's because the city's Department of Public Health said In-N-Out is...
Black diamond on the jumper?
I... It's like a ski slope. You know, black diamond. It's like, I think it's what he's talking about her face.
He's talking about...
Like an angle, I guess?
The slant... Of her eyes.
Oh my! I don't know about that for sure.
I mean,
I just like, what is wrong with this dude?
This is who they are. And
yeah.
Like,
and I wonder if he knows that they were on air. I mean, did he know he's on air
yes,
at that
he's
point?
He's trying or to push the limits.
He just can't calibrate because he's never around people that aren't just gratuitously bigoted.
Right.
And so he doesn't know what the actual line is. As like the guy who says easy, like who realizes like actually we make a lot of money off of a website that has explicit sort of clauses against hate that we've basically been allowed to skirt, so maybe we shouldn't just draw more and more attention to this. I think Emma's hypothesis is plausible, that he's looking for a way to get booted off YouTube and make a big stink out of it so he can make the Facebook or the Fox News rounds and stuff like that.
It doesn't necessarily matter, right? He sees it as an opportunity to say whatever he wants to say and continue like this middle school bully mentality, or he gets banned and then he can make a nice coin off of being aggrieved and canceled.
I just also find it just like, where inside of you does it occur to you to even have the concept of an aggressively Asian face?
Yeah.
Like it's...
Well, and then like the extra jokes, like the one about whatever he said about the black diamond, or when he said the velveteen rabbit eyes, like they don't even really care what the metaphor, like the riffing connects to, because as long as you're riffing about being racist, that's all you need.
Right.
But I mean, I think the velveteen rabbit eyes stuff, though, like they do speak in code on these channels.
They have their own stuff.
You see some of these QTubers and stuff getting interviewed, and you see some of these far right wingers getting interviewed, and they talk about how they literally use specific language in order to get around the YouTube algorithms to say what they want to say. And it's a part of this just like really bizarre communication style where everything's a code, everything's a secret, everything's like a covert military operation, especially with how we're expressing our racist thoughts. And so I would guess that there's something to that. In like some 4chan somewhere that Crowder picked it up off of, and I still think the same thing about the rabbit eyes that he was referring to.
What a reprehensible human being.
Nasty little bigots, those guys.
And what's also is amazing, just like how like utterly cowardly. Utterly cowardly.
Yes, it's always with like they'll run from it the second they're
I'd love
the flashlights pull.
Say that to her face. Yeah. Say that to her face. Piece of shit.
All right, that's our Crowder segment for the day.
Wish it was more fun, but he's just so vile,
disgusting. It really is
rancid little boy.
Stunning. Here is Jim Jordan. I guess is. Should we play this one? Let's play
this.
Let's
just stay in the muck.
Yeah, I mean. And Jim Jordan, of all people, like talking about any type of like anything to do with school. This is a guy who completely ignored the multiple students he had. I think it was at a college, right? Who were coming up to him he was an assistant wrestling coach, I think it was, saying, "Hey, we're getting there's some people being molested by the team doctor." And Jim Jordan, and I'm just saying this because this is what the players said. In public hearings, that Jim Jordan, ignored us, like literally just poo-pooed us, said, you know, pretended like he didn't hear what we said. And we have seen the images of school board members being threatened, harassed, physically harassed, far less dramatic than someone reading a prepared statement to them outside of a bathroom stall, which was like national. It was like a national tragedy, which happened to
Arizona ASU saying that they could potentially press charges against those protesters.
Yeah, just absurd.
By the way. Yeah, so good use of resources.
Here's a House Judiciary Committee hearing with Attorney General Merrick Garland, and Jim Jordan wants to make an issue of Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice basically sending out a memo to state and local officials. If you need help, let's say some of your school board members are getting death threats that you suspect you need more resources in a way to maybe track that down or whatever it is, we are available. That was the extent of that letter that Jim Jordan now wants to make into some type of like huge conspiracy. But of course, this is what the Republican political agenda, I mean, electoral strategy is, as Dave Weigel told us earlier today. But here is that.
I think they're going to stand up to this accelerated march to communism that we now see. America's going to fight the good fight. They're going to finish the course. They're going to keep the faith because Americans value freedom. Mr. Chairman, we have a video we'd like to play.
Mr. Chairman.
We have a video we'd like to play.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dean.
I object.
What purpose does Ms. Dean seek recognition?
I object. I'm reserving my right to object to the video.
Why
may I inquire as to whether the gentleman has followed the Judiciary Committee's AV protocol by providing 48 hours notice to the committee's clerk that he was going to use a video?
We provided notice. Well, first of all, there's no 48-hour rule. It's not in the committee rules. Second, we did let the committee staff, the majority, know that we had a video,
responding
and we gave the video to him this morning.
Responding to the gentle lady's request, he did not. He did not supply the 48-hour rule. 48 hours notice required by the rule.
Mr. Chairman.
Then I insist on my objection. Failed to follow the bipartisan protocol, I insist on my objection.
An objection has been heard. The video will not be shown.
I appeal the ruling of the chair.
The ruling has been made. There's been an objection.
There's been an objection.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak regarding...
That's out of order. This is not debatable.
Well, what's out of order is there is no rule that requires a 48-hour notice. That's what's out of order.
There is such a rule.
There is not. Not in our rules.
Mr. Chairman, what are you afraid of?
There is such a rule. You objected last year. You were told there was such a rule.
Mr. Chairman, what are our colleagues on the other side of the aisle afraid of? Are they afraid of videos? Of parents?
The gentleman was recognized for his opening statement. Is he finished with his opening statement?
I'm not finished with my opening statement.
I seek recognition for a parliamentary inquiry.
It's not a rule. It's what you said. I think the term you use is it's protocol.
The gentlewoman objected.
The conduct of the committee, rules do. That's not a rule. We had a video. We understood you had a video.
I seek recognition for a parliamentary inquiry.
Gentlewoman objected because you failed to follow the rule. Her objection is sustained.
I love it. F Jim Jordan and his dumbass video.
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, that's maybe he can replay that.
Has he released it online yet?
I'm sure he has.
So what is it, like Mama Bear's giving speeches or something like that? Like, it's not going to be people grabbing, other parents because they're pissed that they can't get heard about masks or CRT or whatever the hell.
I think they should actually just play it because you know it's going to be bat crap crazy. And... make them really own that kind of stuff.
I would imagine that he didn't even submit it on purpose so that he could,
of course,
know that it wasn't going to get played and he could say that he was being censored.
Yes, because release the video.
That's a very good point, because this message of "we're being unfairly censored" is the message way more than any actual content they're spreading,
without
right,
a doubt.
Right, it's this and it's the CRT thing, and it's like the masking / vaccine thing, and that's the through line between both of those cultural projects that they're going to engage in for the next few years.
All right, let's do some IMs, and we'll head out of here.
Ah.
We won't have time for calls.
Oh.
What did you...
Well, you said we were going to go long, so...
Yeah, I got to do a pre-tape. Folks, I should just tell you as a little bit of house cleaning...
Housekeeping, I think.
House cleaning and keeping. My schedule is going to be a little bit funky over the next couple of weeks, just because I'm in the sandwich, as they say. You know, where you're dealing with your kids and your parents a little bit. Mm-hmm. So On Monday, we'll have a pre-tape, but I'll have a pre-tape interview, but it's going to be a live show,
right.
And Emma's going to be holding down the fort. So bear with me. I appreciate your indulgence. A little bit of indulgence. I appreciate that.
And I appreciate you giving me even more power.
That's right.
I got to move this onto the... Say that again.
I appreciate you giving me ultimate power.
There you go. Somebody was... That's like one of those... laser eyes, thirst traps.
I was setting it up.
Right?
I was
laser
setting
eye,
it up.
Thirst trap. Did I get that right? Did I say that right?
A thirst trap?
I know what that means. Yeah, maybe not.
You know what a thirst trap is because we did Suns Out, Guns Out. So you engaged in one.
Hold on, I gotta
unwittingly.
See what that means. Oh, all right. Sorry about that. I wasn't quite sure what the meaning of that was. Trying to stay up with what the kids are saying these days and didn't quite nail it.
Didn't,
all right,
didn't
well, that's okay. That's all right. That's all right. We can cut that part out in the post. All right. I'm sorry. I guess that didn't work out the way that I thought it was.
I
thought it was a more generic term. I didn't realize. I just Googled it, and I just saw
a bunch
of guys with taking pictures of themselves with a shirt on in front of their
yes,
mirror.
Yes, that's so, yeah. It's like something you post on your Instagram to like trap the flies, aka people, to hook up with you.
It's like Tulsa getting out of a car and taking her a suit jacket off to reveal a swimsuit and getting in on a surfboard. That's
yeah.
a thirst trap.
it's Tulsi's workout videos.
I thought it was more like a way of like trying to get attention, but I didn't realize it was
you,
specific.
You had your
type of
your
attention.
Blank reach round moment.
Oh, thank you for raising that.
You're welcome. But I mean, it's good to know that I'm not the only one that throws out phrases that I don't fully understand and then regret it later.
Oh, I feel like I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Sink Mansion's yacht. We missed you, Samuel, our best friend and closest confidant. Chat policy. Someone in the chat called me fertile, and I just like to correct the record. don't be silly. Andy Murray is a feminist. Questions for the white men on the show. Did you ever flex your white male privilege to get a job over a woman or a person of color who deserved it more?
That's not how it works. It's more implicit, right?
I don't know. I'm not
the
even
privilege is that like you're the,
you don't have to flex.
Exactly.
But I've never acting jobs. Like, I don't know. I'm in a field where it's, did you ever passively accept a job over a more qualified woman or person of color? I've never really worked in an organization before.
Yeah, me neither.
I've never had that experience of even of ever being chosen over a job over somebody else other than like an acting job.
I'm sure it happened at some point.
I mean,
you're not a white male.
Well, I'm a white woman.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was in like McDonald's, Old Navy, those types of jobs. I don't think I was going over anybody. That's just as far as like this job, I don't know how many other people applied. Vice, I don't know how many other people applied. And that's kind of my professional history.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though. It's hard because it's probably unknowing, you know? It's probably, if it is any at all. Like, I don't know who interviewed with
me. By that point, like, yeah. I probably got into NYU in part because they didn't have a whole lot of North Dakota students. And I think you get some points for things like that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Deontological consequentialist. Sam, they say that imitation is the sincerest form of... Let me also say, though, that I would say this. Broadly speaking, I think, you know, my advantages started probably when I was quite young and not even conscious of jobs. You just don't know. You're just set on a certain path because certain segments of the population have been sort of like systemically held down. And so you got a wider open playing field, certainly, you know, particularly for people in my generation. the moment I'm born, but I don't, not in like a specific job. Deontological consequentialist. Sam, they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, so does that mean you're secretly a fan of hot gay comics legend Dave Rubin? Wednesday, you joked about doing a bit just asking people what road they came in on, which sounded a lot like Dave Rubin asking people what their demographics are. Sam's the minimus penis. How much smaller could Biden's package get before it becomes totally useless for injecting the kind of liquidity into the economy that the country is desperately dripping for?
Disgusting.
On a related note, how is your dating life going? Nerd Cheetah, I could check in a year from now and you'd still be pretending that it's Democratic ineptitude that leads them to lose for their constituents again and again. Why has Schumer been weak? Why was Bernie so late with that op-ed? Why isn't Biden... Why isn't Biden applying more pressure and so on? I could travel back in time a couple of years and hear the same from you regarding the impeachment, Kavanaugh, the Democratic COVID response. A little further, whining about Stein voters and anyone who dares to say the system is rigged. At some point, you'll figure it out. Well, here's my question to you. Why do you even, A, why would you listen to the show? Why would you engage in politics? It is completely rigged.
Yeah, even down to Bernie.
Bernie's
scheduled on.
It's completely rigged. Obviously, the idea that you think the Stein is not part of this as well.
Yeah, not a GOP operation.
You don't think that she's a limited hangout, dude?
Yeah, that's stupid.
You don't think a Stein's a limited hangout, too? Like, Bernie and Stein, they're just different flavors of the same product. It's all just to keep you thinking that there is some, that there's actually even politics. Mm. I mean, why wouldn't you think that, like, that's just a way to keep you engaged? You're the one who's behaving completely irrationally. Why would you even care? Like, what would be the value of me doing this on a daily basis? To awaken people to the fact that every single person they could vote for, it's irrelevant. Every single legislative fight is irrelevant. Everything that happens is irrelevant. Like, why would I waste my time?
Right.
And why are you wasting your time? You're the one who believes that.
These are all just actors acting out a script is silly.
Now, here's the part that's really going to blow your mind. I'm part of it, too. So isn't this show and all the shows. It's all part of the matrix. It's all connected.
And you're at the center of it.
I mean, honestly, like, it's quite possible that what you're saying is true. It's quite possible, in fact, that we're all...
Well, some of it, like, Biden, I don't think, gave a F to do a full $3.5 trillion bipartisan deal. He never got out on... Because I think that's who Biden is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not because he...
I think it's just, like, woefully stuck in a different era. Like, why would you, as a president, come out and roll out a package of things that you know that you're not going to get? Like, what is the value other than... to hoodwink a certain quadrant of the extremely small number of Americans even paying attention to this, incidentally, into thinking that there was a chance. Like, what is to be gained by that? I think what is more likely is that we, including Biden, including Bernie, including Ted Cruz and
the squad,
and Stein and the squad, we are all just part of your dream.
Right.
And you are...
And you're the pure one who understands the
whole
system.
When you wake up, we're gone, man. Yeah. So that's what's really going on here.
It is funny to think that everything's a coordinated psyop and then mention the Green Party.
Well, like...
But what's left, though? Like, if everything is a psyop, like, what is the... Where is the real stuff happening?
In your mind. Or in your life, like that's the weird. It's a lack of imagination, or it's a simplicity to make things make sense, but things aren't that simple.
This is also, incidentally, why I get annoyed at people for saying there's no difference between JFK and why they would have killed him. But anyway, go on.
I don't have anything to say yet. I just want you to read my message name. Sam Cedar Sextenuating. Oh, Sam Cedar Extenuating Circumstances of Silliness. All right. Our quest, seeing a lot of people in the online left getting their takes out about the tragedy with Alec Baldwin because it's Alec Baldwin. This was a real person. They're dead now, respectively. Shut the F up about it.
Great.
Yeah, I mean, I think really, I mean, what struck me was the failure of the prop person and the system of checks that should have gone on in a production like this. Like, the prop person does this, but the AD is also supposed to check this stuff. And I don't know if it was like they were trying to save money or what. I mean, there's some reports. I think like the local union said this person was not a union hire. And so that it's conceivable that this person just was not rigorous in what they were doing. I mean, it is a tragedy.
I feel horrible for the family and the person who passed and the director who was hit, but I feel horrible for Alec Baldwin too. I mean,
don't I think he wanted to shoot someone dead.
Of course, Jesus. Of course. And it was according to the New York Times, it was in the midst of either a rehearsal or a scene, so it wasn't, you know, I don't know. It's still, I don't even want to comment on it that much because it's still happening. It's just such a tragedy.
Left-handed stranger, what's the play now in Texas? Try and salvage any possibility of going purple. Are we really going to have to rely on non-districted elections to fix this? I want to move to the mountains in Colorado. I understand your feeling. It's always snowy in Ottawa. Stan being on The Bachelorette would literally break the show. They don't show the cast talking about anything political, so they would keep their audience as broad as possible. Stan would break them down with his constant talk about politics.
I think about that a lot. Like, if I was ever on the show, not that I would ever be, but like how I would covertly ask the male contestants about their politics in order to suss them out. But
attorney Andrew, Sam, good luck this evening and potentially tomorrow evening. In response to Emma's comment last week, I would ask the audience to Google Yankees and unseal the letter, and then in a separate search to Google Red Sox and Apple Watch. And in another separate search, I would like the Red Sox fans to Google the name of their current manager, see what he was doing for work prior to 2018. Alex Cora took a slight break from working because of his involvement with the Houston Astros, who are as an institution, cheaters and horrible.
That's true.
And it infects people around them.
But everyone's like getting hired again who had the stink of that. Like, are the Mets going to hire Carlos Beltran back? We'll see.
Today's the day. Strategic incompetence. Biden was never progressive, and it's weird that people think he's a version of Bernie. But what's weird to me is that you think that people voted for Biden because they thought that he was a version of Bernie. Like,
no one thought that.
What I don't understand
Bernie
is...
Bernie would have won if that was the case.
What? There's no one who is IMing me. And there's very few people in the country who, if Biden had come out with whatever the number is... that we end up landed on and started there, and that's what had passed, would say, like, I'm really surprised and disappointed in Biden. Like, the concept that Biden would pick the number of the infrastructure bill and include these things and then purposefully sink it because, now, are they willing to cut bait when there's, I mean... I don't know how they move this more. Were they willing not to expend their political capital? Like, for what possible reason at this point? Like, it is just look at his numbers, for God's sake.
Well, it's like, you think no Republicans wanted to get rid of the ACA? Like, right? Like, just use a different example, like Beck and Trump. Like, Trump couldn't get all the Republicans to get on board to get rid of the ACA. And I think there are definitely a lot of Republicans who definitely wanted to do that. But there are certain, like John McCain and the senators that, you know, he was representing by doing that. It's hard to get these senators on the same pitch. The failing of Joe Biden isn't that, like, he's orchestrating all this. It's that he's doing nothing affirmatively to try to address this failing of the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And, in fact, I would say not only is he not doing anything affirmatively to address this failure of the Democratic Party, he is, in essence, the built-in failure. Look, there are 98 senators. I mean, excuse me. There are 48 Democratic senators or caucusing with them that want to pass this. I don't know that, like, Joe Biden said to Kristen Sinema, look, here's the plan. You thwart me, and from that, you're going to probably lose your primary next year. That's a great plan, isn't it, Kristen?
And you'll make me look weak to everybody.
And then, yes, and then you can make me look weak, but weak and feeble. And what I'm going to do is convince the Republicans to put out this narrative that I'm weak and feeble because I am, you know, pretty old and a little bit feeble. And then this will play right into it. And then I will lose in 2024, which was my plan from the beginning, to win in 2020 so that I could lose in 2024. You see, like, if you didn't want any of these things to pass, you know what another good plan for Joe Biden would have been? To lose the election to Donald Trump. Like, this is just
controlled opposition.
So, such a stupid take that this was the plan all along. Like, what is the, why is,
well, because it leads to inaction, because yes, then you can get it off the bus at that point. And
exactly.
Be like, I don't, and fine. Like, you don't need to vote. Like, don't vote. I don't care. But like, to rationalize, like, there's nothing that actually matters, given who, which part of the ruling class exercises power, is just stupid, analysis.
Just, it's just dumb. All right. We should do three more. Majority Report wardrobe coordinator. Sounds like Anderson Cooper should have done that town hall with Joe Manchin. What's the point of being president if you're going to act like you have less power than the 50th vote in the Senate?
Yep.
Biden sounds like a car salesman. We'd love to do better, but my parliamentarian in the back says the best I can do. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That is a good
metaphor. Little Ricky, wrap it up. I'm sorry, Sam. I usually agree with your intuition about this stuff, but Biden and Klain and Schumer and Pelosi have been in Washington for 50 years. They knew damn well if they slow walked the bill, the lobbies from...
We can't. No.
This is just so dumb. It's so dumb. I don't know if you're saying that they knew this is the... Like, why would they then... Why do they get elected? Like, what are they doing with their power? They could just... If the Republicans have the agenda that they want, why wouldn't they just let the Republicans do it? Kinnick, MR Crew, should progressives in the House block the bipartisan bill since the reconciliation bill has been gutted? I know something is better than nothing, but wouldn't a no vote draw attention to the progressive cause? Am I missing anything in this calculation? I think that deserves some thinking about, to be honest with you. I do think that there is maybe some value in not moving any of it, although I don't know. Let's go for a couple more of these and then we're out of here. Alpha Cure Mom bought some tickets for the show. Hopefully you can get someone like John Benjamin or David Feldman to be there. That's great. All right. We'll see. The Chris Lopaco. I need everyone on Twitter to tell Dave Weigel to unblock me. Back in the day, I tweeted about a video featuring Dave and Jimmy Dore and said they were two of my favorite people, but what the hell is on Dave's face? I'm sorry, I take it back. Jimmy is no longer one of my favorite people, but I stick to my comment about Dave's mustache. It makes him look like a drunk.
Why would he unblock you? I love Dave's aesthetic.
Come shower with Crowder. Boston is a much better drive from Seekonk than Brooklyn. Front row tickets, baby. Esper Marin, are you live streaming your show for your European comrades? We haven't talked about that, but we'll see.
I mean, I don't think we'll live stream it, but I mean, we could probably record the audio at least.
Yeah. Emma's Posit Fund. I went to pick up an 18mm 3/4 sheet of Baltic birch. It was $145. Pre-pandemic, it was like $60. I just couldn't justify buying. I've been there.
Baltic birch at $145.
A Rahm Emanuel drive, the Tesla, the irony of Johnny Rotten's political stances these days. All right. Final IM of the week. Illuminati kids. I can see Jason's point about not humming Germ song. Gigi Allen songs, on the other hand, are surprisingly toe tapping. Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job this week.
Thank you.
Folks, we'll be back on Monday.
Yeah, well, I'll be back on Monday. And put lasers in my eyes. I want to see that. Somebody. From before.
Bye-bye.
Oh.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm going to get there. I
should